mein auf den Super Knast.
Welcome to the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who Podcast, episode 321. I'm Adam, and it's just me. First time ever. Well, maybe not the first time ever. But nevertheless, it is just me, so I've got no one to take the mickey out of. And also, I've got to be on my best behaviour, just in case any celebrities may be listening to the show. So, usual listeners to the show, please be aware that the normal chaos will return as soon as possible. We have lots of clips to play for you this week that I've recorded while at Dimensions, the convention I attended in Newcastle over the weekend, and what fun I had. Now, this time I went up to Newcastle and flew up, much easier way, a less stressful way of travelling, especially when you're in mind to have a weekend of rest and leisure, as indeed that was my intention. It was a 50th birthday present from the family, a quite expensive one, but one I was very appreciative of. I caught the 1:55 flight. It was on time and it arrived in Newcastle about 3:05. Got picked up by my cousin, who promptly looks after me very nicely for about 4 or 5 hours, taking me around Blythe and taking me to dinner and then dropped me off at my hotel, which was the Travelodge in Newcastle. There was a bit of a wait the next morning because the convention didn't really start until 1, so I met back up with my cousin for dinner at Marks and Spencer. And then once 1 p.m. came along, it was time for me to start enjoying myself, basically. There weren't a lot of celebrities there at the beginning. And some celebrities were there and I was unaware they were celebrities, so we didn't find that out until later, and I'll explain why. But Jimmy V was the first celebrity to arrive. And I was quite lucky to have the opportunity, one, to have a drink and a laugh with him in the drinks reception, and two, to have this interview. Right, I'm with Jimmy V, who has been in Doctor Who more times than Paul McGann.
Yes.
Can you remember all the characters you've played in Doctor Who? There's quite a few, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Torchwood as well.
Yeah, between that, Sarah Jane, we've got started off the Space Pig, then we've got the Moxable Hoon, then we've got the Grask, Banna Cephalata, the Grosk with Sarah Jane, Baby Sladeen, and finally Peter Capaldi, the Scovox.
And did you manage, is that all in order?
Yeah.
Well done for remembering them all. And you get the first prize, what a... So which of those characters have you enjoyed playing the most?
Banna Cephalata's got to be the best. I mean, he was more or less just playing myself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was a character that was specially written in because Kylie was in the programme.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So Russell Davis actually got it written in, made up that way, that it was like a romance between Kylie.
So he sort of wrote it for you,
yeah,
in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought you might say that, actually, because obviously that's the character that sticks in the mind. But of course, they brought back a very similar character, didn't they, for the end of time?
Yes.
But that was quite a short
cameo. Between the green ones, yeah.
Yeah.
The green family.
Yeah. Have you got anything on the cards that you're allowed to?
I start on Sunday, but we start on a new one here in Sunderland, train set.
Mm-hmm.
So I play like the ladies man, just a normal part as myself.
So, yeah, I was going to say.
As the ladies man,
yeah.
Which is it's a comedy, zombie, love romance type thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, he was a very nice, humble and approachable chap, so I got on really quite well with him. He was also particularly good at flirting with Emily from Big Finish. What I'd like to divulge with you, the schedule that we had for Dimensions, if I can get it to load up, and as per usual, and just what, here it is. Yeah, so Friday's schedule, basically the signings began at 2 and went on to 5:30. We had Derek Martin, who used to be in EastEnders, of course he was with Havoc, and he was also an actor in Doctor Who as well. A very interesting chap. I didn't realise he was 85. He looked very good for his age. He did a talk in the evening as well, which basically about the earlier part of his career when he was sort of involved in crime also, and the other jobs he had and how he got into acting and subsequently being asked to be a stuntman on film and TV. That's how he obviously got into Doctor Who. The second part of it, the Doctor Who part, which I think was the next day, I didn't get to see because I was a bit busy doing other things. But he's a really nice and approachable chap as well. In the evening on the Friday, there was a drinks reception, which is where I was able to sit and have a chat and have a bit of company with Jimmy. And that was really good fun. But it was quite a sort of slow start to proceedings, but we did meet a few people in that earlier part of the event, one of which was a quite a talented chap called Chris Thompson. And this is how we approached Chris at the beginning. Right, sir, if you'd like to introduce yourself, if I can actually speak English, that would help.
Hello, I'm Christopher Thompson.
And now he's going to become...
Patrick Troughton. Hello there. What a lovely day it is. But it's not the only voice I can do. I can do others.
I can do Peter Capaldi, if you like. Yes, hello.
And, hello, I'm the Doctor, Matt Smith. Possibly. I don't know.
Chris was great fun to have around because he was always able to come up with a very interesting impression of one of the earlier Doctors. And, of course, you may hear some bumpers from Doctors later on in the series because he was particularly good and particularly convincing vocally. Some of the Doctors that probably will never appear on the show. The next person to have a chat with was the very nice and very lovely Rob Shearman.
Shall I make this out to you?
Yeah, Adam. Yeah.
Adam. Hi, Adam.
Well, you don't want to talk to him for the podcast. He's a terrible person to interview.
Is he? Oh, good.
I can fill in the gaps.
But I've got better. I mean, I did their podcast some years ago.
Ah.
It didn't go down very well.
They edited it out.
Well, people complained, didn't they?
They did, yeah. You know, what on earth are you doing talking to that Shearman? He's just, you know, saying all stuff.
He's just in it for the money.
He's just in it for the money, yeah.
I own it for the money. Which is unfortunate considering there is actually no money.
I'll introduce you. There's Robert Shearman now. What's coming up?
What you mean today? Or
In the world.
Oh, I see. I've just finished a book.
Yes.
Which I'm hoping will be out in the next year. Called We All Hear Stories in the Dark.
Yes.
But I can't say who's publishing it yet because I'm not entirely sure myself. Yeah, I find self-publishing a bit. It's like admitting defeat, and also it's bizarre because I can't afford myself, because as that publisher I demand a lot of money, and then I refuse to pay it, and it becomes very, very embarrassing for both the sides of my brain. So no, I'm doing some TV and film work at the moment, but I'm hoping to do some more Doctor Who again soon as well. I'm hoping to do another Big Finish,
yeah,
my first in about 10 years, I think.
Is that long?
Yeah, it's been about 10 years. And it's been about 14 years since my last full-length one. So,
how long it took to get Dalek? What's called Dalek was an adaptation, wasn't it?
I don't see it as adaptation of Jubilee, actually. I always saw it as just... There was one scene that Jubilee and Dalek kind of share, and after that it's a different story. So, and I couldn't... I was quite resistant to the idea when I did Dalek of thinking... Let's tell the same story again, because actually part of me as a fan would have found it awkward that the story happened twice. Not because I believe in canon, and not because I believe my stuff is canon, because if I made it up, I know it can't be real. But I didn't want to sort of set the idea that all Big Finish suddenly may not be real Doctor Who. And I just thought, so no, I saw Dalek as a separate story. People often compare the two, understandably, but I think that they're actually very, very different coexisting things.
So there is some Doctor Who coming up then?
I hope so, yeah. I mean, Big Finish have asked me back a few times over the last few years.
Lunging at me, aren't
they? Yeah, John Barrowman is currently lunging at us. Strangely, he's actually not talking.
I'm not very happy about it, is he?
Well, no, but that's because John Barrowman is a very, very miserable man. No one's ever seen him smile or be cheerful at all. He's a strange, taciturn individual, John Barrowman, which is why it's weird he's just looming over us now.
Yes.
Oh, well, There he goes. Yeah. Bye, John. He came to the convention totally impromptu, didn't he? And he's just stalking around. And no one's noticing him at all. Because he's being so subdued and quiet.
Have you written anything for John recently?
Have I written for...
John.
John? Yeah. No. No. John, I think... has got far too high principles for me to write with. Obviously, I've tried over the years to write to John. I mean, I've said I'll write anything for you, John. I'll write speeches for you to go on loose women with, and John always says no. I only work with the best.
Yeah.
Not just one story season one 10 years ago failed Doctor Who writers. And I say oh right then. No. This isn't what I'm saying. This is what John Barrowman say. At that point, I get quite angry with John, and I say, I think that's a very, very unfair way of calling me, John. But no, it's just the way it goes.
I sympathise with you.
Yeah. It's hard. Yes.
Let you get on with the big queue.
Thank you. Yes.
Behind me. Thank you very much.
You're very, very welcome.
Catch you later.
Thanks, Adam.
Cheers.
And the good thing about that convention, or one of the good things about it, was that I indeed did catch Rob. Several times later, not for interview, but just to have a chat and to get him to sign a couple of our business cards and some doodles that he did. One for me and one to give away on the show at a later date. Stay tuned. Now, also among the array of stalls and people selling stuff like that, was a very talented lady who, unbeknownst to her, ended up knitting our new podcast mascot, which is Knitted Doctor, which is the fifth Doctor knitted. Colin Baker actually bought his own Knitted Doctor. If you look on the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast Facebook group, you'll see pictures of me with Colin and Knitted Sixie. However, this is Jackie.
Okay, my name's Jackie Thornton, and I'm a hand knitter, and also a Doctor Who fan. So, of course, the two went together and I started making Daleks and I started making Doctors. And it's just grown and grown and grown.
And may I say how magnificent they are. Notice Colin Baker's been carrying his...
He is. He bought himself, which is...
He bought himself.
He bought himself this morning, which is a little odd, but there you go. And they go all over the world. Very big in America and Canada, but also places you wouldn't expect, like Buenos Aires and Greece. And
yeah.
There are Doctor Who fans
everywhere.
So John
Travolta's got one then. Oh, you mean Greece?
And I also do Lord of the Rings characters. So yeah. I do Gandalf and I do Hobbits as well. And
so you're knitting now. What are you knitting now?
I'm just knitting some of those little alien things that are on the front of the stall.
Are they quite quick to knit, are they?
Well, the pattern's easy to remember. And when you're doing when you're actually on a stool, you need something that's easy to remember. So if you put it down, you don't get lost.
Oh, lovely.
Some of the doctors can be a little bit complicated to do.
I imagine they can be, but they're absolutely... I mean, they're very exclusive, aren't they? Very sort of...
I don't think there's anybody else that's crazy enough to do them.
I can't tell you how much I love them. What's your favourite item that you do?
I think the Daleks.
Yeah.
Because I started off doing them in...
I love how camp they look.
Well, I started off doing them only in traditional colours. And I would say that the traditional silver grey with the blue on is still the most popular one that I do. But then I sort of... thought, well, why not do them in funny colours?
Yeah,
you know,
that's great. It's a really good idea.
And the pale ones are often sold for people for baby showers.
Yeah. I know which one my older daughter would like. It'd be that one. My younger daughter would like that one.
Well, that's it. That's it. They all have their own preferences. And I was talking to somebody earlier, and we were saying that the thing about Daleks that even non-Doctor Who fans know what a Dalek is and they love them.
Yeah.
You know, they're just so unique.
Yeah,
and very, very unique.
As is your
knitting. Well, thank you very much.
If somebody wanted to come and find you and see your work, where could they...
I have a shop on Etsy, which is E-T-S-Y, and my shop is called Woolly Thoughts. Mm-hmm. But if you do a search on Etsy for Knitted Daleks, you will see them.
Excellent.
They're always on there.
I advise people to do just that. Thank you very
much.
They
make lovely Christmas presents.
Very good.
Far be it from me to deny people a platform to sell stuff on this show, especially as talented as the people we had selling things on this particular convention. I'm going to go back to our schedule again now, because those recordings were done on the Saturday, which was the first, well, the only full day of the convention, really. The day would start for the gold ticket holders like myself with a group photo with all the guests that were there. We had to wait around a little bit while everybody got up. And then it was running the gauntlet of photo sessions. And if you wanted them, autograph sessions, it would run throughout the day on a specific schedule. What I will say, it was sometimes a bit difficult to switch from one schedule to another. So I wrote my schedule down on my phone. Because it was on two separate pages, it just made it a little bit easier for me to understand. But even then, I still managed to nearly miss an opportunity with Sarah Madison, who was a weeping angel in Doctor Who. Of course, you wouldn't recognise her as a weeping angel. All you would see is a very, very pretty lady. She was quite not as visited as much as some of the other guests, and I nearly had an opportunity to interview her, but just as I went in to interview her, they found something for her to do. On the Saturday, like I say, we had an interview, a photo with Jimmy V, sorry, and then had Sharon Deuce, who is quite a well-known face on British TV. I suggest you Google her. She was in Ghostlight, among other Doctor Who stories. Another very nice lady. Big Finish had Rob Shearman at their little corner for 2 days, actually, and he was quite happy to talk at long length, as you just heard, about any subject, mainly his writing for Big Finish and Doctor Who, and he was signing books and, obviously, like I said, cards for people and doing little doodles for people. So he was very approachable and very nice man, and he would say hello Adam throughout the weekend, so obviously had some impact on him. He was able to remember my name. At 12:20, as it says in my schedule here, was a photo shoot with Colin Baker and Sylvester McCoy, which wasn't included in the gold ticket package. You could have your photo with individuals with that package, but if you wanted a group shot that wasn't a part of the package, then you'd have to pay for it. And I thought it was well worth getting a photo with two doctors. So that was great fun. I missed out on the Derek Martin Doctor Who stage talk because there were photo shoots going on, and it was also lunch. But I did get a picture with Derek Martin. One of the highlights of the weekend was the Sylvester McCoy Coffee Club. Now, the Sylvester McCoy Coffee Club was one of a number of coffee clubs of various celebrities they had during the weekend. This is the only one I went to. I was slightly late to it, actually. I did take my recorder along to it. And sorry about the audio quality, but it was put on a little shelf behind Sylvester's chair. And, of course, any creaky noises you hear are Sylvester fidgeting in his chair, so I apologise for that, but it's well worth listening to.
I see you've got a different hat. How many do you own? How many hats do you own?
Yeah, I don't know, really. A bunch. They're all piled up. And then sometimes they all fall down, and I say, oh, I didn't know that hat was there. This is one of them. I'm like, oh, that's quite good. I might wear that, really. It's kind of fair. Yeah, business.
Should you auction some off then, Sylvester?
Pardon?
Auction some off, maybe.
Auction them off?
Cherry.
Oh, yeah. Could do. Yeah, I've no hat.
But then you have an excuse to buy more hats.
Yeah. That's true.
To replace the ones you've auctioned.
Yeah. Yeah. The charity could be the Buy Sylvester More Hats Fund.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Are you? New hats for all.
Yes. Where did you get that hat? Yes, they're tiles. They call them tiles, don't they? Which is That was a thing.
Hello, sorry about late.
You're late. I've got a note.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Are you all right now?
Yeah, I just think that's my boom.
At this point, there was a break in the recording while everybody moved their chairs around to allow the new people to sit down. And once we'd all moved around and Sylvester had spotted my recording device and I passed it off as a phone, we resumed.
Are you sitting comfortably?
Yeah, thank you.
Hello,
the
dentist in the house? We've got a doctor. So, is anyone here a virgin? Cool shit. Anyone here a convention virgin? Really? Is this your first time?
First, non-BBC sort of funding. Because the only ones been to have been the festival and the celebration of the XL.
All right.
So apart from doing Skype link up to America, which you've been involved in the past, but it's my first one, as in... but this is lovely. Which I've done before.
Yeah, the nice thing, I like the cozy ones.
Yeah. One of the friends is having a doctor who's in the show, but maybe someone in the south of England would be more comfortable than me.
Yeah. Well, I've
traveled
to South America for a doctor convention, yeah.
They have a really good one over Long City.
Oh, No, they kept it a big secret, didn't they?
Yes, they did. They're changing the name of it too.
What are they?
Yeah, I don't know what it's going to be, but it's not going to be
Economicon. Oh, is it not Economicon?
Yeah, not anymore.
That's not a good one, is it? Mm. Well, especially when economies are going down the pan. Economicon.
It was good for the band.
Yeah.
Had to lay down and talk to people.
That's true, though. It was quite relaxed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we had an earthquake.
Wow.
Yeah.
In Oklahoma.
Something to remember.
We'll call it a fracking.
So, we're in a fracking earthquake.
Because we were getting ready to go to a party and it was on a 55th floor and I said, do they have earthquakes in Oklahoma? And everybody went, no. We had one, all right. Yeah. It was a good one, too.
5.6. Because there was one 5.7 four or five days later in another country, another continent, they had about 10 people were killed and 100 people were hurt. So it's quite a big one. It shook the whole... It was weird because it was 7 o'clock in the morning. I woke up and I went to the door, stood in the doorway between the bathroom and the bedroom, and I was swaying, thinking, this, what happens now? And I thought, this is ridiculous. I mean, if this concrete building collapses now at my head, this bit of wood's not going to hold it up. And then I thought, during the Cold War, they used to say, if a nuclear attack, what you do is get the door off the hinges, put it on the slider there, and then get a mattress and hide under it. Yes, yeah. That'll keep the nuclear explosion away from
it. Very well for the Conservative Party conference in Brighton a few years ago, did it?
Oh. The IRA?
Yeah.
Yeah, but that is. But
the whole building collapsed with the ones with the bomb, and they're all in bed, and beds don't work too well as a protection from collapsing buildings.
No.
Not
good against radiation either, you find. No. But
the planet doesn't
work
on water,
sorry, Booker's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's rather script. I'll find a way around in the script. The 12th Doctor one does work on with
us. I'm sure.
I'm lost. Oh, I never heard that. Well, I think they gave me one for the film, the Sylvester McCoy and Paul McCartney. and they gave me a kind of screwdriver, and I pointed it at the master who was in a box, and I was told that I did it the wrong way around. So I was supposedly exactly.
He's checking for something.
Yeah, but he pointed the wrong way.
Oh yeah.
What?
Sonic screwdriver.
Is that mine?
Box. Yeah. This is the end. Yeah. Okay.
You're spitting image of him.
Apparently you have
that. They moved me because I used to be. Able to...
Well, that's the thing.
Oh, they've got him now. They give me. Where is my sonic screwdriver?
Yeah.
Is that mine or is that his?
That's his.
Well, is that the same one as that one?
Mostly.
Because he would have taken that one over.
Yeah.
Anyway, in the film, he gave me that.
Yes.
And I pointed the wrong way. And then they saw that and had to pixelate that bit of the film. So if you look at it, you won't see the point. Because it has a pointy bit. One point is a pointy bit of the thing. But it turns out that I was actually zapping me. I couldn't be out that film without
all the rest of the film
might be
an hallucination induced by Sonic and the...
Exactly. Sonic.
Well,
yeah.
I thought it was
pretty bad. Yeah, it was made to be a cosmic force. It was used to come back and deal with them, like, you know, it would be like, it would be generally well, like, because when I had to do, Colin, play Colin, I mean, you know, I'm a double for Colin Baker, aren't I?
What a big one.
Yeah. Put me in his costume and they lost me for 3 days.
Oh, is that how you turned up in that scene? Of course, because that character, the brother, Gashi, was lost.
Oh, yeah.
Is that, that's how you got there, or?
No, he was smooth. Exactly. He's skinned.
Yeah.
He lived in his wardrobe. I like that role.
You did?
I like playing it. But when I read it first, it was very funny. But when I did it, it turned out to be really tragic and sad. And Elaine C. Smith was standing watching the scene and she was crying by the camera. And after we finished, I said, I can be funny. Honestly, I can be funny. But it was the way the character developed. You couldn't do it. Because he was such a tragic character, you couldn't do him, take the mickey out of him. You had to do it for real.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up being stuck in the lunatic asylum 3 years afterwards. Because I played it so well. Anyway, I wasn't it. I wasn't acting.
First time I remember you was in Vision On.
Oh right, gosh, you've got a good
memory. I'm old. You're only young yourself in those places. And then,
well, it must have been.
Yeah, only about not 20 years.
And then, yeah, 40 years.
Then Tis Was.
Tis Was, yes.
Yeah.
When I played a plant.
Did you?
Yes, I played a flower, and David Bellamy played by
Lenny.
Yeah. He used to pull the hairs out of my leg. Or whatever it was, is it? That was funny because when I did that, I lived in London and we recorded it live in Birmingham, and it wasn't shown. I did it for 3 years. The first 2 years, it wasn't shown in London. So I used to, I was actually doing a play in the West End, and after the Friday night. I got a car would pick me up, take me to Birmingham. I get up on Saturday morning, do this insane show, and then come back by train in the afternoon, and then do this play in the West End, can't pay, won't pay, in the evening. So it was kind of a very hectic time. I was quite young, so I could do all that kind of stuff. But I had no idea what, they were seeing the program, so I didn't know what happened. I just did it, they gave me a lot of money, and I was quite happy. Then a few years later, I did a play in Nottingham. And I was rehearsing, and then anyway, I came around the corner, and a whole lot of skinheads came around the corner, and they all looked at me, and they went, and then it was like slow motion, you know, like, and they came running towards me, and I went, oh my God, I'm going to be killed, and they came up to me and said, oh, Seal, we love you, do you want a chip? And it was, they were, you know, fans of that.
This
was. Because it was, it used to attract skinheads and football balloons. It was for children, this program. But they loved it, and it was kind of.
I've never seen it. I've heard of it.
Yeah.
It did finish about 1984, 3 or 4.
Oh,
it's so
good.
Yeah.
That was a
child. Chris Tarrant was close.
It was a big student thing when I was at uni.
Yes, students as well. Yeah, it was students, skinheads, football hooligans, and everything. Because students used to love it. A Saturday morning, lie in bed with a hangover, and watch it. And it was a thing of putting custard pies in people's faces.
Yeah. It's an adult one.
Yeah, they've met up one that didn't
over the top.
Same as Alice Jeff.
Yeah.
Yes, well, that was a late night one.
Yeah,
and the reason why it didn't work, the reason why Tis Was worked, was that it was done by ATV, and they didn't have a children's department, so they didn't have an executive looking after the children's shows that they did, and so they just got on with it. And there was a low boiling point. If you did it on children's program, you could get to rude bits really quickly. There's the low boiling point on it, you know. And it didn't have to be that rude, but it was a bit dodgy. And people used to like that. Oh my God, I'm chilling with it. But whereas when they moved it to the evening, I mean, doing this stuff with custard pies and down ladies' fronts and all that kind of stuff, that kind of didn't work because what you had to do was take on the establishment in the evening. Like, that was the week that was. You know, that was the kind of program it could only be in an evening. It had to frighten the people, you know, who ran the place.
It was like a carry-on film, the night version.
Yes, it wasn't. It didn't work because they were just trying to do a slight amount, just a bit older, a bit, you know, just was work, sadly. But anyway, so good fun while it lasted.
So other than Doctor Who, of course, what's your favourite role? What's the best thing you've been in your
ham role?
Ham role.
Well, I'm an old ham, so I'm happy to keep the ham caught out. Well, my favourite role, the hundreds of roles. The thing about being an actor is that you do tend to fall in love with the role you're playing, necessarily. It's like you have to, you know, really, you know, like it. I mean, there are some roles that I've played that I've hated. I can't remember what they are now because I've forgotten them quickly. On for the next. But, you know, I enjoy playing the Fool in King Lear because that was one of the great Shakespearean roles that for many years the RSC and various other people who did King Lear always cast an actor in the Fool role. I mean, you know, traditional actor in the Fool role. And I always thought that. And therefore, it wasn't funny, because it is a tragic role. Mm. But the fool is funny. So when I got my hands on it, I kind of tried to make it funny so that when the really sad and horrible bits happened, then it would be a great contrast. So I enjoyed doing that and kind of making that work the way I always thought it should work. And other people kind of seem to like it. I mean, Trevor Nunn came in and said he's, you know, run the RSC for years and been around. He said that he'd never seen such a funny film, and that was good.
It's probably more like it was originally anyway.
It would be, yes.
Yeah.
But also, I don't know if you know King Lear, but the young Cordelia, the daughter, is that name? Yes. They think that was the fool played that. Because in those days, you know, the
women were on the stage.
So they think, because she was never on, they were never on the stage together. And at the end of the play, King Lear carries her down, and she's dead, and he holds her, and he said, "My poor fool is hanged," and he looks at her. And, you know, they think that that was a tie-up, that the fool actually played both parts. But luckily for King Lear, for Ian McKellen, he didn't have to carry me down. And he's back in. My poor back is hanged.
Well, I saw you playing in Southampton. I think it was called Noises Off.
Oh, yes, that was great.
Really
fun.
Really good play, that.
That's why, if you ever, it's a brilliant play. If you've never been to a play and want to go and see one, go to Noises Off. It really is the funniest play that's ever been written, especially the second act. It's
almost ingenious. It starts off, it's behind the scenes. So you're behind the stage watching what's going on behind it.
No, it's the other way around. It starts off the play. They're doing the dress rehearsal. Mm. And the director is in the audience with a microphone. And the lady comes on and she's doing the play and she puts the paper down. And then he says, no, daughter, you've got to put the paper up there and then you pick the phone up now. And then, oh, she said, oh, that. So they're doing this kind of working it out. And then the second act is on tour a few months later and you see it from the back. So you now know the scene, you've seen the scene from the front. Then you see what's happening backstage. And they'll hate each other, all trying to kill each other. And physically, and it's very, very visual because it has to be, because backstage people are just, you know, they have to talk. So it's a very visual. And then the third scene that it doesn't really top the second scene. It's the best scene in the play, but it kind of just winds it all up.
We haven't sat in the audience with Fincher, and he was quite near me actually on that particular performance.
Oh, did I?
Actually,
yeah. Oh, I did, did I? Because I said, you know, at the beginning, Lee Lawson had played. We had Philip Franks playing the director. If you know who that is. Anyway, he was in the audience at the beginning giving instructions to Dottie, or the character, for the first. And then he had to go away to do something else, and Lee Lawson, who did it on Broadway, came and was doing it. And he was telling the story. He said, when I was doing it on Broadway, he said, you know, I said, oh, Dottie, come here. And someone turned around and said, why don't you shut up and let her get on with it? I wish I'd been there.
So if you don't have a favourite role per se, do you have favourite actors that you particularly like working with, or favourite teams that you particularly enjoy working on?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Richard Briers, I work with him, and a Doctor Who seal thing.
Paradise Talk.
Yeah, and it was hilarious. I mean, the problem was to try to get through it, he just kept laughing all the time. I mean, he was great to work with. Ian McKellen is very good in film, working with him on film. He's a bit tricksy on the stage. He likes to be the centre of it all, even when he shouldn't be. But anyway, that's an actory thing, I suppose. But when we were filming on The Hobbit, he was great. He was very supportive. And there's this thing where, you know, you do a scene and then you get your close-ups, you know, and the other actor doesn't necessarily have to be there. An AD arc, or someone could, an AD, whatever it is, can actually feed his lines to you, and you just react to them. But he was always there. Ian McKellen always went there, even though he was exhausted and we'd been working for long days. And people would say to me, "Ian, it's all right. You don't have to be there. You know, just someone else can do it." But he was always very good at that. So he was good. Yeah, Bob Hoskins was great, because that was the very first person I ever worked with in the theatre. And in fact, I learned. I didn't know anything about acting. I was got the job by mistake. I was mistaken for an actor. Many a critic has said it was a bad mistake, but anyway, I've done it. But Bob, I just watched what Bob Hoskins did, and he was very physical, so I did very physical stuff. So that was great working with him. Zoe Wanamaker, I love working with. We did Seven of Two Masters many years ago, and it was just quite magical on the stage. It was just amazing. I hadn't seen her for years, and I bumped into her the other night. Just bumped into her and seen her. And we just kind of all took us back to that time when there was magic on the stage. Sometimes, yeah, if you work, it could be magic and great fun.
I imagine those are the ones that you remember most fondly, the ones that you have most fun actually doing.
Yeah. Yes, lots of fun, really.
Which Doctor Who episode was, or story stands out in your mind as being the most fun to work on?
Well, I mean, I suppose the one that was most fun, the one that always sticks in mind is Survival. We were filming it in Dorset, and there's a big sand pit down there, mile by miles of sand. The desert of Dorset, as I call it, because we filmed there twice. The Greatest Show in the Galaxy and Survival, and both times it was a heat wave. It was over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and it was just like being a spaghetti western in Survival, I think. So, yeah, because I got to ride a horse and all that kind of thing. And it was very hot. Now, we had the cat people in Survival, and the girls had to wear fun fur, kind of nylon-y suits, you know, cat suits and makeup, and there was no shade whatsoever, over 100 degrees. There was no trees. We were in the middle of this desert. And one of them completely freaked out. And she just stripped off her costume. It was last seen running over a sand dune. But the only thing was that she forgot she was only wearing a thong. But for some reason, that's the one that always sticks in my mind.
course you got to ride a motorbike in Belgium and Berlin, didn't you?
I got to ride a motorbike, yes, but oh, I wouldn't call it riding a motorbike. Yes, was there another one I rode a motorbike?
When Survival, yeah.
Yeah, there was two. And Sophie Aubin, she had her own leathers and motorbike. She arrived, you know, for the interview and said, what do you do? And said, well, I ride a motorbike. And they never gave her a motorbike to ride a motorbike. I remember Delta and the Bandman, there was a lovely moment where Bonnie Langford was in the sidecar and we were going across a field, and the field was like a kind of a rolling sea that had been frozen in green, you know, went like that. And we were going, and every time we went, Bonnie would just, but we were there bouncing up beside me, and our hair would go, and then later on, we were driving down a street in a country lane, and there was a Welsh actress at the back of me, I wish I could remember his name, a lovely man, and he was out the back and Bonnie was in the sidecar, and we were around the corner, and I'm sure, I would swear that this, the bush ran out into the middle of the road because I went right into it, and the actor on the side of me flew over this way looking rather worried as he passed by and landed in the bush. So there was all sorts of things like that that went on. But then on the other one, the one you just mentioned, what was it again?
Survival.
They gave me this big bike. And we were up on a very high plateau. And they wanted me to get on the bike and drive way onto the distance. And I said, okay. And then they said, okay. And they went, oh, could you just move it down a bit? And it was in a hill. So I had to go down the hill. And I kept saying, well, can I do it on the flat? You know, start off in the flat. And they said, no, go down the hill. It's a better, it looks better at the back. The background looks better. Just clouds. You know, the clouds can round or something. Anyway, they got me. And so I started off, action, and I went backwards down the hill. And then somebody kept trying to do this. And eventually, and then a crowd gathered round. And it made me really nervous because it was a very big bike. And eventually, my got it to go forward. But I mean, it was going like that forward. And I'm surprised I didn't kill anyone here. I just went through this crowd. And then I carried on this bike. And once I got used to it, I was quite enjoying the speed. But then I suddenly noticed that just beyond, there was no more grass. In fact, there was nothing. I was about to the edge of a cliff. And I thought, how do you stop this thing? No one turned my head. I would stop a bike. How do you stop it? So I just went completely down and skidded, and then didn't quite go over the edge of the cliff. So yeah, that's my bicycle adventures.
One of those things in my mind, not to do with riding motorbike, is that brilliant scene. Galaxy where you walk away from the tent and the explosion happens.
Oh, yeah.
But you carried on going as if it hadn't.
That was interesting because it was the very last day, the very last shot, and it was coming up to 6 o'clock. And
there was a strike on as well.
Yeah, strike unions and all that kind of stuff. And it had to finish, it had to be done. And it couldn't be repeated. And it had this big tent, and I looked in the tent, and there was this kind of gun. Well, it was like a tulip, really, with an opening. And I said, what are they? What's that for? And they said, oh, it's just rubbish. It's all the gods of Ragnaroks and detritus. It's just showing this, that all their powers have been blown away. So this great wind and all this stuff will fly up behind you. I said, oh, great. Then so there was action. And I walked past and suddenly the whole Second World War started up behind my back. Explosions, heat, flames, everything. And I remember thinking, I've got to keep going because it's the last shot. I mustn't blink. Keep going. And I didn't know whether I still had any clothes in the back of my head. And then suddenly the smoke swirled around and I could go,
one of my friends was a red can, actually. Well, no, she was only an extra, but she was a red can, and she got embarrassed by it. We actually watched that story through to try and find her amongst the cans. Eventually, we did find her in episode 3, but
it was her, was it?
She was indeed in it.
Oh, since I was born, really. Some are born.
on helping others achieve it. I didn't really become an actor professionally until I was 27. And I've always been a bit of a show off. I've always been a show off. And when I was working in the box office at the Roundhouse in London, and Brian Murphy of George and Mildred fame and Last of the Summer Wine and all that, his wife was assistant administrator. So when he wasn't working, he used to come and hang around the theatre and collect the tickets that I was selling, because I was a ticket sales guy in the box office. And he just presumed I was an actor. And when I had a director come in one day, he recommended me to him, and I became an actor.
My cousin's son's done a tour, of course, at Stratford, and he's working in Stratford Cafe.
Hoping
to be.
Stratford.
Yeah.
All right.
He's been there about 2 years now.
Yeah.
So, I suppose you've got to see any parts coming up.
Yeah.
You know what he's like. Apparently, the Lord's got the lead part in school plays. And, it's a 2-year acting course at Stratford.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's maybe it's a way in, but it's difficult. It's not easy. It's just luck, completely luck, and who you know.
Yeah.
No talent, really. Fair example. So, yeah. Mine was just complete luck. Someone mistook me for an actor and gave me a job.
Well, so, such what Derek said last night, was it?
Derek.
Derek Martin.
Oh, all right.
So were you planning on being something else, and then, or
if you're good at acting?
Yeah. No, I like the costume.
Excellent hat.
Yeah. Have you seen the shoes? Derek Martin.
Charlie in EastEnders.
Yeah, Charlie. Well done.
Oh, God, that's Derek. Yes, I am. I only knew it was Derek, really. You don't say the two names. I can. Yeah, no, it's luck. I did try actually train to be a priest. That was before I was mistaken for an actor. And I think the reason why I wanted to be a priest was I grew up in the Highlands of Scotland. There wasn't any much theatre. So when you went to church on a Sunday, you know, there was this guy up on a stage with a great costume, you know, and everybody was looking at him, and I thought, I want to do that. So it wasn't in any deep religious reason why I wanted to be the Pope. But anyway, I went off to train to be a priest. And then I decided to become a monk, rather than a secular priest. So I wrote off to the Dominicans, and they wrote back and said, yes, join us. And so I left the seminary to go home. And then when I got home, they said, you're a year too young. So I was 17. I had to go to school, and luckily where I lived, the Dunoon Grammar School was the only school around for hundreds of miles. I went to that, and it was a mixed-sex school. So very quickly, I decided not to wear a skirt, but chase it instead. Years later, I did a documentary about Blair's College, and I met this priest who'd been my teacher. He's a Monsignor by now, and we were chatting, and he said, if you would have stayed on, because you came from Argyll in the Isles, it's a beautiful kind of wild part of Scotland, for those who don't know. He said, they're looking for a new bishop for the Argyll in the Isles, and you're the right age, you could have maybe been that bishop. And I was a moment of regret, because I thought, that's a great role. Because he arrives and votes, you know, there all those islands. He's at the front, you know, with his stave and his hat, arriving and blowing in the wind, you know, that kind of stuff. I'd like to play that role.
It's basically being a wizard.
Yes, it's the same thing, really.
Incidentally, I'm from the Highlands, and there's still not a lot of drama.
Five years later, this bishop, the guy who got the Bishop of Argyll in the Isles, he ran off with his cleaning lady.
So he was clearly chasing skirt.
He started chasing skirt. Yeah. And I thought, God, that could have been me.
Was she nice?
I don't know. I didn't run off with her.
I know what you're saying. It could have been you, if you wanted to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that documentary you put where you went to India.
Yes.
Did it make things come back? Because basically the idea was everybody would perhaps find somewhere nice to stay or live out
there? Well, no, the idea was to explore and find out what it would be like to retire there. I think we all agree that you could retire to India quite happily. But none of us are giving up or retiring. Mm. Bobby George kind of was thinking, before he did it, of thinking of buying somewhere warm for the winter, really. And he may still might. But it was a wonderful adventure. We had a great time.
It was. Everybody really enjoyed it.
We did enjoy it, in spite of the production team. They were appalling. They were quite appalling. They were, you know, just... They had no idea. I think they'd only ever worked with animals before or something. They made us work for 15 hours. One day, one of the other days, we went 8 hours without eating. Mm. They'd leave us in hot vans waiting for the, you know, to start a shot, and leave us 2.5 hours and tell us what was going on. And they also, when they approached me, I said, I didn't want to do a reality program. They said, no, this is BBC Two, we're not going to. It's going to be a documentary and, you know, an exploring. It won't be anything to do with reality. And then the researchers come, they chat to you about things, and you chat. Then the week before we were late flying, another researcher phoned up and started asking personal things about my relationships and my son. And I said, wait a minute, this has nothing to do with this. I'm not going on one of those. I've been told that this is not what it is. And then they said, oh, my agent got in touch with them, and they came back and said, no, that researcher shouldn't have done that. We're sorry. Don't listen to it. Then we go out there, what they do, a reality program. I mean, it's very popular. It's won a big award in Berlin, TV film festival. And it does work, but at the same time, they got upset because I refused to do anything about exposing my soul to them, because that's why I wasn't there, whereas a few others did. And they did it, you know, I thought the Wade Sweet was really touching in his bit, and Rosemary was quite interesting, and the others, but that wasn't what I was there for, and so therefore I, you know, refused to do it. And then so they took their revenge, because in the last one they just kept cutting to me looking miserable. And that was, we were 8 hours in the hospital getting checked up, and that was interesting and good, and we found out none of us were dead. It was a bonus, you see. So, but we didn't eat, and so when they cut to me, I was just sitting there going, you know, really tired, exhausted, and very hungry. So that was it was a bit disappointing that they did that, but they did. Because there was lots of other things we did. There was a big, huge parade, I ended up on a camel, riding a camel, and things like that. And there was another bit in the slums of Jaipur, and we went in, and it was fascinating. Luckily, I'd read Shantaram. Has anyone read that book, Shantaram? It's a great book. It's written by an Australian who was done for drugs, and he escaped from Australian prison, eventually made his way to India, and hid in the slums of Mumbai. And he had medical experience, and so he started a medical case for people to go there. And he described the slums, and because I'd beat the slums before in the Third World, been terrified of actually going in. I mean, it was horrible. But the way he described it was fascinating. And then when I went to India, I went into the slums, and it was true. There is a great deal of goodness and community. And what was amazing about this slum was that the children all seemed incredibly happy, and they're all very clean. But, which was fascinating. Anyway, there was this young guy who was like a Bollywood star, and he had a German girlfriend as well, but he stayed in the slum, and he taught the slum children how to read and write in English. And I went to one of his classes, and we filmed all that. And it was touching and moving and everything. Didn't see the light of day in the program.
Oh,
that's
a shame.
But the good positive side about it was that all of us, the performers or whatever we're called, got on really well, because it was us against them.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, I've heard news back from a second one they've made, and Bill Oddie and... is the dancer guy?
Not Wayne.
No.
Lionel Blair.
Lionel, yeah. Bill Oddie and Lionel Blair, well, they're not really getting on well.
because if the crew were really nasty, then they would pull together. So it would be interesting if the crew had been really nice, or else who had been fighting and who on the set.
It's time for this crew to be really nasty. We'll wind up the coffee, I'm afraid.
Wind up the coffee.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Right, okay.
Well, I hope you appreciate the amount of input I put into that particular group. There's about 12 to 15 of us all had the opportunity to chat to Sylvester. And apologies once again for the creaking chair sounds. Couldn't do much about that because the microphone is right next to the metal leg of Sylvester's chair. Now, by avoiding a few of the talks on the Saturday, it gave me the opportunity to meet some of the talented people around the sales area, I think you call it, the area in which all the little stalls were set up, merchandise. That's it, merchandise area. Now, I got the opportunity to chat to an absolutely beautiful woman who's an incredibly talented and successful writer, mainly of horror stories. And she's called Sam Stone.
I'm Sam Stone, and I'm an author of horror, fantasy, and dark science fiction.
And how many publications have you got so far?
I've written 15 novels, about 4 or 5 novellas, over 40 short stories, so quite a lot, really.
Well, prolific, in other words.
Yes.
When did you start?
I started writing when I was 11, but I became professional in 2008. Mm-hmm.
And what was the book that sort of made you professional? You know, the first professional.
The very first book. I wrote my first book. It's called Killing Kiss, which was for my master's degree dissertation. And it was the book that gave me the confidence to try and get it published. I didn't know how to do that, so I self-published it. And it won a Silver Award for Best Horror Novel in America with Forward magazine, so I was delighted. Yeah. And then I got a 3-book deal on that, so that's how it happened, really.
Yeah, better than I did.
I was a bit lucky.
When I self-published my first novel, I didn't even know I was self-publishing it, because I sent it to a few publishers.
That's kind of what I did too, and they come back to you, and it's all money in you.
Yeah, you'll pay this, and
you fall into that trap, you don't realise, that's it.
Yeah, just it's like a roller coaster. You're steaming along, you've got to the editing, and then suddenly it comes out, and you're really, it's booking around that you wrote.
Yeah.
So, and you feel really chuffed, and then you realise that, my wife realised that the royalties at the Apex and my publishers said they was going to cover my investment, and it didn't actually happen.
No, it doesn't happen.
But,
it doesn't.
But in the long term, it led to a further 12 books, which I didn't have to pay for.
Oh, wow.
Which was a quiz book. So over 10 years or so, I did actually get the money back, but I didn't make any sort of profit on it. But clearly it's more successful, because your sort of books are much better than mine.
Oh, I don't know about that. I'm sure yours are very good as well.
Worldwide
I've just sold one to America, to Word Fire Press, which is run by Kevin J. Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be hitting the American market properly very soon, which I'm very excited about.
Do you have if somebody wants to make it into a film or a drama, do you have that sort of, is that part of your...
Yeah, I've actually written a screenplay for my Zombies at Tiffany's book, which is under consideration at the moment with a London-based production company, so fingers crossed, who knows, it might just happen.
Yeah.
I've also written a stage play, which is hopefully being put on next year, but that's not horror, it's actually a family drama, I was thinking more like Tennessee Williams-esque, so it's called Gingerbread House. So I'm hoping that... So I do diversify quite a lot, and I've done audios for Big Finish, of course.
Oh,
I did Doreen Gray.
Yeah.
I love to try everything. I love to cross genres a lot too. I like to mix up the bag and make
like
it exciting.
Sounds like you're going from science fiction to horror to whatever.
Children's books? I don't think I could really write children's books. The closest I've got to that is my YA, my Cat Lightfoot series with Zombies at Tiffany's, they are YA, because there's no sex in them. Mm. But that's about as close as I get to it. There's still quite a lot of graphic horror in there.
Books, right,
there's lots of sex in some of them.
Is that one of yours there?
That's one of David's. That one's Time of the Doctor. Well, actually, no, he did wrote that. That one's a non-fiction Doctor Who study.
So what's coming up next then?
Coming up next, I'm in the middle of writing my third book in the Jinx trilogy, which is a science fiction fantasy series. Well, it's a trilogy.
Yeah.
So I'm on the third one, so I've got to make this really good. No pressure.
No pressure, no.
I must admit, it's getting harder, though.
I must admit, the sequel to my original novel was better than the first one, because I really knew the characters.
And you get confident as well. You've done it once, you can do it again.
Well,
so.
Yeah, you know, you maybe in the first one, you might have held yourself back, and you get into into the vein of it, and the whole world in your head is there, and you're able to sort of write it almost automatically.
Yes.
So I never got to a third, simply because my books are diary novels, so I'd have to write them day by day and then go back and re-edit a plot into it.
I see.
It worked really well, but when it came to the third one, I just didn't have the time and need to do it.
Sometimes you lose the momentum as well, don't you?
There's a bit of that. I did start writing one, because I mean the first one's about a 15-year-old lad who's basically out to lose his virginity, and the second one was just a continuation of that, so he's slightly going up a bit more. And
I mean, that sounds to me like that would probably have quite a lot of wide appeal.
Adrian Molish, but a bit more realistic in some ways.
Yeah.
I only wrote it because
I used to love those.
Sue Townsend, loved Sue Townsend.
Yeah.
She was a woman writing a male character, so I only wrote it. I thought, let's have a male writing a male character, actually experienced it. You know?
Yeah. So, part of growing up.
Yeah. I was quite proud of it, but I can't see a third one coming along.
Do you think you'll diversify into fiction again in another way?
Maybe when I retire. I did write some Doctor Who scripts. I sent them off to somebody, wasn't it? There was a woman in America who does Doctor Who audios. Just for fun sort of thing, you know, she liked it, but didn't ever get it. It's good. It is quite a good script, but I can't write scripts, so I don't know how the format is, because there's a certain format.
There is a format to script writing, there is, and it changes as well. I mean, it's changed a lot. I did my first degree was in English and writing and performance, specialising in screenwriting, but it's changed a lot since then, and I've had to relearn it myself recently, actually.
But where you're actually constantly, you know, doing that, so you're able to keep yourself fresh.
Absolutely. You have to keep yourself fresh
with
everything you do.
The only thing I benefited from it was I never got, when I was at school, I never got really any qualifications, but I was able to actually learn English properly through writing.
And through reading, probably, as well.
I reckon if I did an English GCSE now, I'd probably pass it.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure
I'd
you
just
would.
Put my novel in as the dissertation.
Well, it might surprise you to know that I left school with no qualifications as well, but I went back to university as a mature student and did English, and that's when I did the first degree. And went on to do teaching after that, teaching English and drama.
That's quite an achievement. It shows, just goes to show
just
that
get your degree, and
if you really want something, don't worry about leaving school with nothing, because you can go and learn exactly what you want. You can do that when you're an adult. You can't do that when
sometimes
you're
when you're a kid, you're just dealing with living and surviving in certain situations.
And all that teenage stuff as well.
It's awful, isn't it? Yeah. You'd want to go there again.
And it's all comes at the wrong time in life, doesn't it, really?
It does.
Turns to some people it's okay, and they fly through it and they go to university and then they end up doing nothing of the things they wanted to do, the subjects they learned at school.
Then
they get so stressed out about it, and
there's so much pressure on kids as well to get like 12 GCSEs nowadays. Why don't you just do a really good job of getting by, is what I think. But you know,
and get for your teenage years, maybe have some kids, and then go to a cycle. Yeah. So we get all that stuff you do when you're young out the way, and then you can really do
what you want later, you have a life.
Thank you very much for talking to us. It's been absolutely fascinating.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming over to speak to me, Adam.
Oh, she was so lovely. That was Sam Stone. As the week went on, obviously everybody started to get to know each other, and we were able to walk around and have a chat. And it was easier for me to actually go up to people and speak to them and point a microphone at them. More so when it came to Steve Hatcher, who's apparently the future of a certain podcast that we all know and love so well. And he sat down and had a chat with me in between chaperoning some of the celebrities. I'm now with a seasoned podcaster, Steve Hatcher, from the Flesh and Blade.
Yeah, Flesh and Blade, on hiatus at the moment, but we will be returning very shortly.
When you say hiatus, how long is a hiatus?
I think the last one we put out was January, actually. It's been a while. There's been some complications.
It's obviously leaving Doctor Who. Is he coming in to produce?
That's the exclusive. Yeah. that we're going to reveal. Yeah, or not. So, who are your presenters? Well, do forgive me, because the last time I listened to Flash and Blade, it was Siobhan and that funny chap,
Dr. Zinister.
No, the other chap. Rob. No.
Rob. Yeah. Bob. Robert went by the way, and Dr. Sinister came and was around for a while.
Wasn't Dr. Sinister like a feedback sort of provider at some point?
It came that way. It was him. Siobhan invited him on board, and then Ian Parks and I joined in, and we were sort of alternating for a while with Ian and me 1 week, and then Siobhan and Sinister the next time round. But
Dave involved as well, and then it was a DW Who cast.
Dave's I think been on occasionally, but no, not so much. And since Dave moved to the States, that's
Oh, he's still there.
Oh yeah, no, he's settled there. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. No, so it's basically Siobhan is. This is probably an announcement. Which probably shouldn't.
I should play the Flashing Blade tune.
Yeah, Siobhan is going to be stepping back a bit from it, and it's going to be more Ian and myself who are taking it forward from now on. With Siobhan still around and still contributing, but
just
it's
making sure you do it right.
Yeah. But we're going to be the bosses from now on, you see. So we'll be telling him to do it right.
Tell you what, you give me an idea then, and stepping back and letting the others do it. But I better not just yet.
Yeah, well, it's but the urgency at the moment is actually to get a podcast on. We recorded one back in the springtime, which is still in limbo somewhere. Siobhan recorded one as well in the summer, which is also in limbo. Hopefully, what we need to do now is get those two podcasts online and then start recording some new ones. And that's the plan.
Fill a gap, wouldn't it?
That's the plan.
That's the trouble. I used to do a weekly show.
Yeah.
Weekly, week in, week out. And done reviews of every story now, it's impossible to do a week.
Well, when you look at people like the Radio Free Scaro mob, who do one every week and maintain a fabulously high standard. They're three very talented fellas, but
with time on the hands
as well. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but no, admiration to them, absolutely, and others as well. I mean, Blue Box turn one out every week, and again, a good standard.
Fallen by the wayside as well over the years. That's one sticks in mind is they started off as listeners to Flashing Blade.
All right.
Set up their own podcast.
Right.
That's Wendell and Wes. I forget what. It was the Omega podcast.
Oh yes, yeah.
And they did it for a while and realised perhaps they needed to do other things with their lives and stopped doing it. I think the Omega podcast ran on for a bit and then that stopped.
There's still a good podcasting community around. I also run the Hooverville convention.
Yeah, you told me about this.
Hoovers.
I really would like to go.
You must, because we make it very podcast friendly. And we are at the moment. It's this time of year. Podcasters who are at Hooverville are now putting stuff out on their feeds that they recorded in the convention. Particularly Tin Dog Podcast. Hello, Michael. He's playing lots of.
I don't think he listens to my show.
He'll be there somewhere. and we have a second stage at Hooverville, which we give over to the podcasters to organise. Yes. We provide the guests for them,
and
we put panels together. They do the interview and then record it.
It's a bit of networking. Really good idea.
And right from our first Hooverville, which was 2009, we've wanted it to be a place that podcasters could feel they could come to meet other podcasters. And I'm sure that's what it's become over the years.
I've heard of Hooverville, and it's one of those things I always look up and think, when's the next one? I think I did look for it, couldn't find it at the time in January, and I was looking for something to do with my 50.
Well, we announced it right back at the. Yeah, yeah. We announced each one after one convention finishes. We announced the next.
Yeah.
So our next one is Saturday, the 2nd of September 2017.
Oh, good.
Always do a Saturday, and it's always the weekend after the August Bank Holiday weekend.
That's good because I have Saturdays off.
Ah.
If we haven't got a wedding to film that day, and my wife's in a very good mood, that's not going to happen. the wedding might be the wedding might be doable though, because where we are at Derby Quad, the Derby Register office is next door. So
trouble is, my wedding be on the Isle of Wight. So
no, no, I wouldn't do. No, no.
But if I can get her in a good mood one day, put it in the diary. If we have not already booked for a wedding that day, I could get Debbie Melrose, our co-host, to go to it, because she's now, after posting the pictures from this one, she said, "Oh, I wish I'd gone now."
Put it in the in the diary.
Yes. Hang on.
And then don't mention it to your wife. And then when she sees it, you say, "Well, we discussed this. Don't you remember?"
She's not that daft.
You have to be convincing about it. You have to not waver at all. No, no, remember.
Well, I'm going to take what's putting it in the diary advice that you just... Oh, we've gone
Saturday, September the 2nd.
Hang on, Saturday.
And it's not just podcasters. Everyone else is welcome as well. Got no guest at the moment.
No guests? Not yet. Who have you had in the past?
Who haven't we had? We've had Peter Davison.
We've had me.
Colin Baker.
Yeah.
Twice. We've had Peter Purvis.
Yeah.
We've
had... He's here tomorrow.
He is, yes. We've had Fraser Hines. We've had Katie Manning was there this year, and Janet Fielding and
Katie.
Sophie Eldred and Nicola Bryant's been in the past, and
an array of stars.
Lou Jameson's been, and Matthew Waterhouse was there last year.
He's here tomorrow.
He is indeed. Yeah.
Is that right, Dave?
That's the one.
Right,
that's
in. And we've had no wedding that
people.
Day. So.
Ah, good news. We've had all sorts of great people, because next year will be our 9th one.
Yeah,
and as well as Hooverville, we, as the Hoovers group, we do our monthly meeting about four or five times a year. We'll have a guest at our monthly meeting.
Mm.
So our November 2016 meeting on Friday the 11th of November is with Nabil Shaban.
He's been on the show. Very nice man.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking forward to meeting him.
Yeah.
And that's at the Voice Box in Foreman Street, Derby. Foreman, as in Susan Foreman, but no, because there's no E in it. Foreman Street, Derby. The Voice Box, Friday 11th of November from 7:45. We've got Nabil, yeah. And again, everybody welcome to that.
Yep.
And we charge the reasonably ridiculous price of £10 for those.
So if you wanted to go and get a ticket, and hopefully some of the listeners will want to do the Hooverville thing.
Yep.
Where do they need to look? Do they need to Google the Hooverville, or is it
Hooverville? Yeah, or there's the we do have a Hooverville website, which is hooverville.org.
Mm-hmm.
Which we try and keep up to date. Then tickets are they're not on sale yet, but when they are, they'll be on sale from Derby Quad.
Yeah.
And that's derbyquad.co.uk. Quad is our venue.
Yeah.
And we have this brilliant way of doing a convention, that what we do as the Hoovers group, Hooverville is our convention, but we sell it for the day, if you like, to Quad, to the venue. So the venue, Quad, is a brilliant state-of-the-art art centre in Derby. And they pay for the convention. They pay us a fee to organise things, to pay for the guests and so on. So we get our convention without actually having to put out any of our money, or not being much of it anyway.
Yeah.
So we don't take the risk, and it's come off every year so far.
Something we're lacking on the Isle of Wight is a Doctor Who event, but I know how much, you know, arrangements and time goes into it, and I don't think any, even though we'd like to, any of us have actually got the facility to do it.
It is time consuming, and you've got two choices as well. You either do like we've done and find a brilliant partner venue to work with, or you put up a lot of money of your own, which we won't
have
be
to
doing.
Get back.
No, yeah.
You have to be, that's the thing, you have to be guaranteed.
That's right, and I know of conventions who have had budgets, operating budgets of £10,000, £15,000. Well, ours is nowhere near that. Ours is much less than that, and it's not our money, which is nice. It means that we're not going to have two or three doctors to an event, but we can sometimes, some years, afford one doctor.
Yeah.
And we can afford lots of other good companions, good companion actors, or other guests as well. We've had some good people over the years, and I don't think we've had, we haven't had a Hooverville where afterwards we haven't felt it's gone well. And it's built every year, we've got bigger and bigger every year. We're about at capacity with Derby Quad now, so
good.
We're anticipating we might sell out one of these years.
How much are the tickets normally for that one?
£40 for the day, and there are various reductions for kids and for
unemployed people. A gold ticket thing.
No, don't do any of that. No, don't do any of that. Because, we don't need to, because at
Nashville. Autographs are free. We don't charge for autographs. And photo shoots, yeah, we charge for the photos, which go professional photographer.
Yeah.
But no, we don't do gold tickets or anything like that. So we don't need to.
That does sound very appealing to me, but like I say, I might have to work on that one.
Well, we do get people. Whenever we announce the convention, we get people coming on and saying, £40, that's a fortune. I can
pay
£10 to go to Comic Con, whatever. Yeah, and then you pay for this autograph, and that autograph, and this one.
That's a good price for me. A good price. Obviously, trying to fit everything in the one day is quite difficult. I found going to the London events, it's a very difficult thing. But if it's arranged well enough, you can do it.
You can, and if you organise it so that you're absolutely on the dot with starting and finishing times of everything, it helps that we've got two main halls. So we can just say we give the second one over for most of the day to the podcasters. But we know we've got that where if we want to squeeze another panel in, we can do one. We can do two at the same time. Which, it's never ideal, but we know.
We've got three British presenters. That's me, Andy, and Debbie. Mm-hmm. So that'll be like two fifths of the team. So maybe I can persuade them to go along.
Well, this is it, because
and myself.
It's the podcaster's place, and it's where you'll meet all the podcasters.
Yeah, I'd really like to do that. I've bumped into a couple of podcasters. Yeah. We went to the Doctor Who celebration. We bumped into the old Doctor Who podcast.
They've been in the past,
but they're not doing it anymore.
There's
a couple around here actually that said. Because I was speaking to Robert Sherman and they said that he talks a lot, he came on our podcast, so I didn't get a chance to speak to them, so maybe I'll catch up with them later.
What we've had over the years, the Staggering Stories people have been brilliant supporters. They're there every year.
Yeah, nice to meet them.
They're good people.
Because they've heard of us, so it's always very nice to speak to people in the podcast and where they've actually heard of you.
Yeah.
I had a very funny moment with somebody and they said they never heard of us, so I sort of on the show I said, right, don't plug them, don't need to do them.
We had the Blue Box people this year for the first time. We've had Michael Tin Dog has been every year and has been a brilliant supporter of our event.
Yeah.
And
Tim Drury.
Tim's there every year as well.
He's heard of me. Graham Sheridan used to do that, but he'd come from Germany, so he probably wouldn't be there. But yeah, that'd be something. That'd be really.
And Lou from Money.2 podcast.
The legend that is.
Yeah, he's been a regular supporter.
Yeah, because obviously we've been going for about 7 years. The ironic thing for us is that when I started to do podcasting, it was through listening to the DWO Who cast.
Oh, yes.
And Paul Wilson.
Oh, yes.
And Paul Wilson just recently moved to the Isle of Wight.
Right.
And has offered himself to join our podcast. It's a bit like going full circle. And I feel like the idea was perhaps to start the podcast up and then end up presenting the Who cast.
Well, that would be really good to hear Paul podcasting again.
Yes, that's what we're hoping.
He's a good podcaster.
He's a brilliant podcaster.
He's been missed.
Yeah.
So
that's all right. He contacted me on Thursday, so shall we have a meet up? So no, I'm going to Newcastle. Oh, so
he did a couple of Whovilles as well.
I think it appeals to him because he likes doing the podcasting, but he doesn't want to put the work into the background, the stuff that I do basically. So but that's fine by me because it's like a dream come true in a way, having sort of my mentor coming on our show. But it hasn't happened yet, but that's what I'm aiming for.
He came to our first two Whovilles in a sort of twin capacity because it was when he was working for Big Finish, and he also came as a podcaster, so that was really good. He's a good guy.
He's working for, we were talking about his work for Big Finish.
We'll
have to have a chat with Emily about him.
He used to work on their website.
Of course he did. Anyway, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm sorry to interrupt your lunch.
No, that's absolutely fine. But what I'm here to do is I'm plugging Time Shadows, which is charity Doctor Who short story anthology, which is published the other month, and it's in aid of the Enable Community Foundation. And it is there's all sorts of people written for it. Forward by Gary Russell, and then a whole load of us who've written for things like Doctor Who Information Network, Mythmakers in the past, and Big Finish Short Trips, and I wrote some of those in the past. Edited by Matt Grady, and it's available as a paperback copy or as an ebook, and you can get it from Pseudoscope Publishing, PSEUDO Scope Publishing.com. Time Shadows, it's called.
and I recommend it. And it's inexpensive. I'm not going to be able to quote you a price because we're selling them here today for £10. And I think it's slightly less than that online, but then you pay postage as well. So.
Oh, yeah.
But they're available to get
hold of. I know somebody will probably buy that. That's Debbie Melrose. She's a prolific reader.
I recommend thoroughly. As I say, I've got a story in there, so I have to recommend it. But forget that. Put that aside. There's a lovely collection of stories. I said I was involved a few years ago with Big Finish Short Trips. I did a few of those. And I think this collection is every bit as good as they were. It's a professional standard fan publication.
And good. It's nice to have a few stories within one about binding, really, isn't it? It's an achievable thing to actually...
Yeah. Well, we've seen that a few times recently, haven't we, with the rather fabulous Seasons of War that came out the other year.
I've got one off Rob Sheeran, actually, for £3, which was a collection of Big Finish.
Absolutely.
Yes, excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you, Steve. That was great, because Steve also helped me to gain access to some of the celebrities on the last day and get some decent interviews. So thank you, Steve. I'm sure he understands the boat I'm in most of the time. On the Friday morning, I had a stroll along the Tyne to see when the convention was actually going to start, because it was a bit unclear. Bumped into a couple of people dressed as the Doctor. So I had a bit of a conversation with them on the bank, and they remarked about my long scarf, and I sort of embarrassed myself by trying to be funny. And failing dismally. Doesn't happen very often, but on this occasion it did. But as the weekend went on, managed to acquire a couple of new friends, amongst others. And they promised that I could film and photograph their forthcoming wedding in 3 years' time. They were fantastic, and they were very enthusiastic cosplayers, and I had a conversation with them about that.
Okay, I'm here with a couple of superstar cosplayers, one of which might not say anything. So we'd like to introduce yourselves.
Yes, I'm Aaron, and I'm a second Doctor cosplayer at the moment, but I'm looking to do the fifth Doctor in about 2 years' time.
Okay, come back to that in a minute. Go on, he's going to say something.
And I'm Leo, and I cosplay the seventh Doctor. And that's who I'll be staying with.
You're going to stay with the seventh?
Yes.
And who do you say you're going to do next?
Fifth Doctor.
Of course, you were telling me about the comprising of the costume.
Yes.
So would you like to remind me the best place you can find these
Yes, of course. Things? There is two places that you can get your costume from. One being Magnoli, which is a costume maker's, for specifically in Doctor Who. The jacket for the fifth Doctor is called the Edwardian frock coat, and that is about £300, but that you've got to get from overseas. And there's another website which is run by Steve Ricks, who's one of the famous cosplayers within the community as well. He runs his own company, and it's one of the pages is called Making My Fifth Doctor Costume. And he makes the jacket, he sells the braces, the trousers, and it's all custom made to suit the person who wants it.
Magnoli is also where you can get the 7th Doctor cosplay jacket from, or safari jacket should I say. And you can get that in a variation of colours, going for ivory or brown, and that will cost you around £300 as well, roughly.
That's a fair price to pay for an outfit, basically.
If you want to do it screen accurate, then yes.
Are you the types of people that like to do it screen accurately?
Yes, we want to try and get it down to a T, so get it perfect in a sense.
So there's different levels of cosplay.
Yeah, there is.
And you're right, you're aiming for the top level.
We try.
So have you sort of moved up through the levels in time?
No, we've sort of gone straight into it,
That's the sort of weak thing I do if I could actually find the costume. But now you've given me that website, I can achieve eventually, hopefully, my ambition of going as the sixth Doctor. In fact, once upon a time, I came close to wearing the sixth Doctor's actual jacket. I had a photograph taken on the back of Bessie with Colin Baker and Alistair Pearson. And Colin Baker took the actual Doctor's jacket off and put it on Alistair Pearson and not me. I thought that because he'd put it on Alistair, that there'd be another picture taken where he put it over on me. But that didn't happen. Never mind. I'm still trying to get him to wear this, actually.
I haven't seen him yet.
If you do decide to do the Sixth Doctor, which variation would you do? Because there's two variations.
I would do, because I've got this,
yeah.
And Colin has told me that each episode had a different cat. I'll find out which episode this cat was from and get the matching. I think it's probably likely to be the lilac-y, dotty sort of neckerchief thing. The shirt would be a difficult one to get.
You
so I think it's
bat.
Got, I think it's got like a stitching down the middle.
Is that red check? The red check pattern.
Yeah.
The cravat.
I say it's probably difficult to get, but probably possible.
So you can get the check shirt. Okay. I think that's
get it on Magnolia. It's about,
right.
I think it's roughly £100. I think.
Yeah. Shirt, and that's
it could be
made.
50. I could be wrong.
That's probably one I'd go for. Although I quite like the braces outfit he wore in the Two Doctors. But yeah, that's what I'd go for. That because I could do this. I've got the physique for it. All I need is a blonde wig.
But you've also got the audio episodes, which was a blue jacket.
Yeah, I know about. No, there was. Is it downtime? I think was that the.
No, it's real time.
Real time. No, it's had time in it. It would be. It's a Doctor Who production, isn't it? I talk about the word time. It always makes me laugh that my employers, my boss would say, have you done so-and-so yet? And I'd say, no, I haven't got time. And they'd say, well, make time. I thought, if I can make time, Stephen Hawking would be well impressed with that. I am slightly sidetracking here, because we're supposed to be talking about cosplay, but this does happen, unfortunately. So you're going to continue on. Once you've achieved your next... are you going to... Because he's going to stay as the seventh.
I'll probably stick as fifth for a while, but I am looking eventually, if it's possible, to do First Doctor.
Yes, so say you went to a convention and you had a specific doctor there, would you aim to try and dress as that
maybe
doctor?
Not, it depends
it is all,
really.
It
well, it all depends really, you know, if I'm in the mood to, I might do, but two of my favourite doctors is Hartnell and Davison, so I might just stick with those two.
And I did Sylvester, he's my favourite doctor.
Yeah.
So once I watched the episodes, I thought, this will be a challenge for me, but I'm going to stick at it and give it a go. See how
you've given me an idea. Because what you say is your favourite doctor, I'd probably like to go as the fifth doctor, but with the dirty duck just after he's regenerated. And so the sixth doctor with the fifth doctor's outfit, regeneration one.
Yeah. I was going to do that with the seventh doctor regenerated. I was going to do seventh doctor in sixth doctor's costume.
Yeah.
And that's something I was thinking of doing.
Yeah, that would be cool, wouldn't it? I haven't seen a lot of people do that. Do regeneration cosplay. And that's something we could go into when I've got some money. I haven't checked my EuroMillions ticket yet, so I could be sitting on quite a lot of money at the moment. Talking of money and stuff, you're getting married.
Yes, we are.
Yes.
In 3 years' time.
Yes, well, still at some point.
Yes.
Yes, who's your photographer?
You.
Am I? Yes. Down on its recording now, you can't get out of it now.
We had a chat about it last night.
We did.
And we've decided that you're going to be our photographer.
That's good. And I did give you a card, didn't I?
Yes.
So therefore you can join the 20 Megabyte Podcast Facebook page, where you can keep in touch with all the idiots and all the people that are a member of this group. Get a t-shirt? No, you have to buy a t-shirt. These are about 15 quid each, these.
Okay.
You can have one. They're very, very exclusive. Not a lot of people have them. The presenters have them, and maybe one of the listeners, because they're so exclusive.
But you could have a car, the car would be.
You've still got over 250 cars to get rid of, I'm guessing.
I'll give them out tomorrow if I've got loads left. Yeah. I've been using them to get people to sign autographs on, and then I realise I've got more photos. So, the big group, which I've got a few people to sign around the edge, and then I realised, hang on, I haven't got so-and-so. So I'd already got Jimmy's yesterday, and I got Sharon, is it? Got her
Sharon
yesterday as well, and she was in the picture, and I thought, well, maybe I should have waited. Never mind. It still looks pretty good. So got all your pictures through yet?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's been such fun this weekend. So I'm hoping it's going to continue tomorrow. And look forward to doing your wedding.
Thank you.
Yes. That's it. We can go now. Goodbye.
Great, lads. And I thank them for their friendship, newfound friendship over the weekend and hopefully in the future. And I wish them well and hope I do end up filming and photographing their wedding. Now, there was one of the talks that I was particularly keen on going to on the Saturday, and that was the one involving Sylvester and Colin. Now, I apologise for the sound quality, because I did have the microphone on my chair, so it picked up the speaker sound, but I hope you can hear what they're saying. Sylvester was on great form, as per usual, and I did consider editing it down, but I couldn't see where to do so. So here's the full thing. Hope you enjoy it.
Obviously, you've done many conventions over the years, and you guys got to know each other very well. But for various reasons, we don't hear into, I don't know if we discussed it before, but you were denied a sort of traditional handover in studio. I was wondering if you remember the first time you actually met each other.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I do.
Yes.
Over to another J&T.
Did we?
Yeah.
I don't remember that bit. Oh, I thought I'd...
In
Ashram. I thought we met in Cleveland. Oh, in a cinema. Remember in a cinema in Cleveland, and we actually did a regeneration scene. You came on saying, I am the Doctor. On one side, I am the Doctor. And then as you got towards the centre of the stage, I came on the other side, I am the Doctor. I am the Doctor. And then I came on, and I knocked you out. That's a lie. Do you remember that?
No.
Do you not? It's out there in film somewhere.
I remember James, he said, you haven't met, so best to have you. Come join us. It was somewhere, it was a restaurant.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I did. And I thought you would love it.
Oh. But it's past tense, he said. I noticed that past tense there. No, no, actually, we did it. That was the very first time I saw you, was that your regeneration scene. Unless I dreamt it. Did I dream it? I said, oh no, there is a regeneration scene out there, isn't there? And they...
But I don't remember anything. I've just been asked to talk about a big finish that I did a month ago. And I can't remember a single thing about it.
The problem with big finish is you get the script, you read it, sometimes. And then you rush in, you do it. Or 2 days, sometimes. And then you rush away completely at the end.
And actors, I don't know if you agree with this, we're so used to, there's different parts of your brain, the stuff you remember forever.
Yeah.
We're so used to putting stuff in the temporary bit.
Yes.
And getting rid of it when the next thing comes along.
Yeah.
That everything just goes tippy-toe out the back door.
I know.
I can't think about anything.
No.
So when you come up to me at a convention, and say, hello, Colin. Do you remember me? We met at the convention in Shrewsbury in 1979.
No, I just came up to you and said, do you remember, Colin? We met at a convention in Cleveland. And you can't remember it. I mean, that's really insulting. I just realised, you can't remember me. You handing over to me. That's amazing.
No, not at all. Cleveland in England.
No, Cleveland in Ohio.
In Ohio.
Yeah.
If it didn't happen, on English soil, it didn't happen.
We were in a hotel.
Am I right? It's not Canada unless you have to England.
Well, it was in the colonies. We were in a big hotel, and you had to move your room because a pop star arrived.
Oh.
Do you remember?
I remember that very clearly.
Yes.
Here was I, you know, Doctor Who, at a Doctor Who convention in a very big hotel, and someone with the hotel room says, oh, Mr. Baker, you have to move your room, please, because we have a big English star coming to stay here, and he wants the whole floor. I said, oh, really? What big English star is that? And it was...
me. drummer from Genesis.
Genesis.
Phil Collins.
Phil Collins.
Yes, Phil Collins.
And his entourage wanted the whole floor. It's a pretty big star, so it's all right. But the convention organisers went to the manager of the hotel and said, you do realise, in England, Colin Clayton is a much bigger star than Bill Collins. Untrue. But in American eyes, I was. And they said, oh, right, okay. And they put me in the penthouse suite. I remember that very clearly. It had a television in every wall.
Oh, yes, no, that was because I was there with my sons. And I couldn't get them out of the loo because there was a television.
Yeah.
They'd never seen a loo with a television. And the
phone. What a waste. There's all my family in England.
Yes.
And there was me in this enormous, great, beautiful suite of rooms. Walking around going, it's all mine. How dull. And I went to the Collins.
Yes, but then you forgot the bit that we met. That's amazing.
I don't remember you at all. Did you know you were there?
I was a big star. They pretended I was Phil Collins to get rid of me. No, I only brought school, it's not my brother.
this is why I'm very, very, I tip my hat to Peter Davison, who's written an autobiography, that's that. He's written an autobiography. How can you remember? I don't remember anything.
I know, but it wasn't like he made it up. I know Tom Baker did, so I mean, why not?
John Pertwee gave me some very good advice once. Because he used to do stand-up and stuff, and he told me these wonderful stories about people. And I said, how do you remember? He said, oh, I don't, he said. I just tell very good stories about dead people who can't contradict me. Good advice, yes.
Colin, you just mentioned Peter's autobiography, so that you won't be doing one yourself to remember, but Sylvester, are you tempted at all to do an autobiography?
Well, I was asked to, quite a few years ago, do one, and they gave me a bunch of money to start it, and they asked for 50,000 words. I did 10, and then I suddenly thought, oh, I'm bored with this. And I'm sure there might be more to come, not realizing how much more there was to come, actually. So, yeah, I've got 10,000 words somewhere.
Did they take money back off you?
Yeah, I gave them the money back. They didn't ask for it, I just gave it back. I said, no, I can't, I don't want to do it.
Well, in a similar vein, this time last year, we were sat on the stage, and I was enthusing about the CD interview that you'd released with Big Finish.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely enthusing. Yeah, I was actually, I was having a bit of a tough time. It made me laugh so much on my daily commute.
Oh, I'm glad we were brought a little sunshine.
You really did.
Are you right down here?
Yeah, I am. Thank you.
Good.
Sharing that little. Again, Sylvester, has Big Finish approached you about doing one of these interviews?
With no.
Me? No? Would you happy to do one?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Stay with Big Finish for a moment.
They're scared of you see.
Why?
I don't know.
Why am I?
I don't know why you're scared.
Explain.
No.
You're late. Have you got a nose? Sit down. Be quiet. Except when I crack a show, then you can laugh.
There's us as well. We're coming late.
Yes. Late.
Late.
Late, late.
Later.
Anyway.
We were talking about this earlier in a signing group. I must ask you, if I come here, about your adventures in reality TV in India recently.
Oh, yes.
A great series, I'm sure. How was that experience?
It was great. It was a huge adventure. It was just quite glorious, and I'm so privileged to have done it. The only drawback was that the film crew were completely... Well, I think they don't ever work with animals. They made us work for 15 hours one day. They got us up at 3 in the morning, flew us to Delhi, then Delhi to the Ganges. We sailed down the Ganges, and Miriam Margolis was under this boat, didn't have any railings, and she was talking to the camera, and she fell asleep, she was so tired. And she was just about to fall into the water when I grabbed her with my mask. Otherwise, I thought, because we were sailing by where they burn all the bodies, and I thought, then what, they want to just kill one of us? Because they make a really good TV program. Yeah, very good. And the burners. But it's great, we had a great time. Wonderful adventure. I'd do it again.
Good.
But they wouldn't allow me because I wouldn't do what they wanted me to do, which was a reality program. I refused to do it because I'd agreed already before I went I wouldn't do it. And they said they weren't going to do one, and then they snuck in one. So then,
what's the difference?
Well, the thing is, it was going to just be documentary, more exploring, more adventure, and, you know, kind of discovering what it's like to retire. But then they moved it into a personalised
one.
People falling out. And there was a falling out, and they wanted us to talk about it. And I refused to. I said, I haven't come here to discuss that. That's not what I'm here for. That's not what I was promised. And then they fell out with me. They kept cutting to me in the third episode, looking miserable. I was just tired. I hadn't eaten for 8 hours. It was in there. Anyway, that's just...
What were the highlights of your time?
Oh, riding on a camel. That was very fun. In a big parade in Jaipur. It was someone's birthday, and they had all these elephants and camels and horses, and they put us up camels and we went down. People were cheering and dancing. And then I got off and there was a big... All these guys were dancing, you know, in the side of the road, and I went in to dance with them. And then suddenly they started body-popping me. They're banging into me. I thought they were going to kill me. It was
scary.
Well, you were messing up their ritual dance.
I wasn't really nice for a long
time. Yeah.
But they were smiling.
Offending the gods, probably.
All right. Yeah. Well, I, that's my job.
That was a rictus, not a smile. Yeah. I'm very up on Indian culture.
Oh, yes. A rictus.
I'm a well traveled.
You travel around Asia or anything you yourself?
No.
No.
No. No, I don't want to do anything. It's hot and smelly. I think that's not hot and smelly. Was it hot and smelly?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They are. They smelly. It smells some amazing smells as well.
But you have seen the Taj Mahal.
I have.
Which must be quite something.
But it was actually quite. But it, when I got the whole thing of the romance of the Taj Mahal, you suddenly realise actually it's a very sad place. And when Lady Di or anyway sat in the front and looked all miserable, it fitted. Because the history of it is, this guy built it because he's one of his wives, his number one wife, had died. So he built it for her, but he also, it was being done for diplomatic reasons. He wanted to impress the other nations around how wonderful a building he could build. And when it was finished, they cut off the hands of all the builders so they could never build that building again. And then his son came along and imprisoned him in a prison just across the road, actually. And if he looked out of his prison window like that, he could see them still finishing off the Taj Mahal. So once you got there and learned that story, you thought, that's a wonderful.
So you've both done stints in hot climates and through reality TV, with I'm Celebrity and the best.
Yes, you've specified you're really bad.
Why?
Right in reality TV.
It's a no bit. Well, I mean, I'm not terrible.
You did that.
I'll tell you why. I hear that you got out because you needed to be out of pantomime.
Yes.
It's the best thing I was hoping to get all your convention gigs.
Well, that's what crossed my mind as well.
That's true.
Well, the last thing I was going to ask you about doing those shows in Australia and New Zealand, of course, and in India. What do you most miss about home?
Well, when I'm there, nothing in particular. Wherever your home is, it's your home. So, in the words of the song, it's nice to go wandering, but it's so much nicer to come home. And it always is. But home for me means my wife and my daughters and animals and all those things. But if I was on my own, I'd probably go all over the world and see what it's all like, really.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of consider the world my home. In a way. I mean, I do love where I live, and I've got a great pad, and, bye, nice seeing you.
It's when you started talking for that much.
I hate it. Anyway, yes, I enjoy coming home, but when I'm home, I'm just a gypsy, really. I love just going somewhere strange. I don't like anything regular in my life. If it's regular, I kind of scared. And I suppose I've just led a very irregular life.
So you're not very regular then?
No, yes, regularly. Regularly, I'm not very regular.
I bet you don't you suffer from.
Pizza mix is good.
Is it? You can wear it on your head. I know you think you're pizza mix to put on your head. And you can play Trump.
I'm not allowed them to
me you're not big fans of
Donald Trump.
The man is, I mean,
it's
just
insane.
Yes, it's sad, isn't it? I mean, he's utterly deranged and dangerous. And Hitler was the same. They laughed at Hitler. And he got democratically elected to, you know, into Germany, and all, look what he did. I mean, this guy's got the same, kind of could maybe do the same if he gets in. That's shut the light. They're just looking at their own death. I mean, don't worry, Scotland will go first, because Trump hates Scotland. We mixed around with his golf clubs and things like that. We put Winterfell Farms off his golf courses. Yeah, he hates the Scots now. He is descended from the Scots. I sent a message to America the other day to someone in America. I said, I apologise on behalf of Scotland for sending McDonald's and Trump. Maybe you like McDonald's, I don't. Except Archie, he likes McDonald's. Archie.
It's not good.
Yeah, McDonald's. He was always queer when he got lost. He was always having a McDonald's. It's okay. Go back to well, that was quite successful, wasn't it? Over to you, Colin.
I'm going to completely change the subject and just talk a little bit about quiz shows. Because, Colin, you've become the master of quiz shows at the moment. Every time I'm on ITV, you seem to be doing a new show. You were on The Chase recently, weren't you?
I was!
How was that experience?
I enjoyed it a lot, actually.
Oh, with your bad knee, could you chase anyone?
I do, I've chased a lot of people.
Oh, right, in your life, I know, I've heard of the chase. Past, but I'm talking about now.
The chaser called me.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it was very enjoyable, but you don't stand a chance, really, because, the chasers are all polymaths, so they know an awful lot of things. And when you're four against one, who's very good, you travel at the speed of the slowest, in a way. So when you're asked a question in that last bit, which is the only really important bit, the bit where you get the money, if you don't know it and you're on your own, you say, pass, get the next question. Whereas if you're with three other people, you don't want to trample on them. So you go, and you look, and somebody else says, and then you get passed. That's three questions gone in the time that you do that. So it's very cleverly constructed to build up hope, because you can do really well up to that point. And then, as in our case, there was, 180,000 we were playing for. It was the biggest amount of money they'd ever had on the show. If you don't win it in the last bit, forget it. Of course, we didn't. It beat us.
And Sylvester, have you done any of the game shows?
Yeah, I did. What was that one? Pointless. Is it?
Yeah.
So, by the celebrity or something like that.
Yeah.
I did that.
Did you do?
With Sophie.
Sophie.
And I mean, the thing is, I didn't want to do it because I really don't enjoy doing those things. So I turned it down. You're going to hate me for this. And then they said, so they offered me 500 quid and said no. Then they came back for 1,000 no. And then they came back and they got to 5,000 and said yes. That's why. £1,000 for doing it. That's not bad. And we came in second.
I got 10.
Colin, sorry, I'm just sitting with Gage here for a moment because I also saw you on the Tipping Point one Sunday.
Oh yes, I want that one.
You seem genuinely surprised how much fun you were having. Was that genuine?
Yeah, I mean, the reason I do them is because I have no great pretensions to be at the RSC or the National anymore. I'm with Patrick Trout and I was shouting in the evening. It's sort of off my repertoire. I've done that, been there, I'm tired. And whereas quiz shows, I do enjoy quiz shows. I enjoy doing crosswords. I enjoy things that involve words and challenges and games. I enjoy that. So if they're prepared to pay me to go and do one, I'm very happy to do it. Because I'm not losing anything by it. If a young actor in their 20s did it, that would be folly. Because you are categorised, sadly, by being involved in those kind of things. But now I'm 73 and I don't care.
And you seem to be getting on very well with Ryland.
Yeah, he was a nice guy. He was lovely. He was very capped, and we don't speak to each other anymore, but we swap phone numbers. Neither of us have used it, but it's in my phone directory, and I was impressed by him.
Tell about that date soon.
Yes.
Actually, I've always thought, since the days of Brian Dowling on Big Brother, that your doctor particularly would suit a camp gay companion. I think that would be quite funny on Big Finish.
Who would you after the job?
And...
I don't know if you know, but to this day, the phrase I've always referred to as Dino from Mrs. Brown's Boys. I was sat with him at the AC and someone came up and asked me if I'd sign a photo of him.
I've seen about 3 minutes of Mrs. Brown's Boys, and sadly that was enough for me.
I love it. I think it's great. I love the anarchy of it, the madness and the silliness. It comes from an ancient variety, kind of history. It's like all that.
Well, I'm going to throw the questions out to the audience in a moment, but before I do, Sylvester, can I ask you about a project you're currently promoting through Facebook, The Circuit?
Yes.
What's the premise behind this?
No idea.
No idea.
No, it's just this guy, American, actor who wants to get it off the ground, and he's got various Star Trek people involved and various other people, and he said, you'd like me to be involved, and I'd say yes to everything. So that's, I said, yeah.
And it's a series of web-based short films, is that right?
If you say so.
Set at conventions. Thank you,
yeah, that would well be.
Okay.
I mean, he was enthusiastic and he was good. I said, yeah, I'll do that. Sounds good. I mean, he seemed like a guy who could get something done. So if you do it, we do it. And if you don't, we don't. And it's a. I mean, I don't really understand. It's raising money over the internet. Yes. I don't know.
Crowdfunding,
yes. I don't know. Find a crowd, fund it.
I think the idea is, what I gather, is he's asking for submissions for stories, which will be turned into films with professional directors, producers, actors. Stories can be anything, as long as they are set at a convention.
Yep.
And Colin, you make a perfect story. You wrote one very similar in Gallimumfrey, didn't you? Your collection of short stories.
I did. There you
go. Could be a film.
Cool. I'm sure if you approach me, I'd sell it to you. Yes.
Right, on that note, I'm going to throw the questions out to the audience. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Hang on, I'll come on. I've never heard either of you talk about Dark Dimension, the 30 metaphorical story that never happened. How far are either of you involved in discussions and what are your memories of the actual 30th anniversary?
It wasn't very good, really, was it, Colin?
I read it. It arrived through my door unannounced one day. I read it, and the first scene I read was said, the Doctor, and it was a good scene. And then there was another scene that said, the Third Doctor, and it's very short. Then it was the Doctor, and again, for pages and pages. There was another scene that said the Fifth Doctor. That was 2 pages long, and he was gone. And then there was lots of the Doctor, the Doctor, the Doctor. Then there was the Sixth Doctor, 2 pages long. And then there was the Seventh Doctor, 5 pages. You've got more pages. and we worked out that the Doctor in this script was Tom.
Yes.
So basically, it was a 200-page script with 160 pages of Tom. And a handful of pages for each of the rest of us. The story was much similar to a whole lot of Doctor stories. And we were all disinclined to do it.
I mean, John Pertwee was incandescent with anger, right? It was just rather badly, really. It's a bit like the 50th anniversary, you can tell that one. Everyone else questions, hands up.
Clearly, where are
you? Nobody, okay, come on. Well, there you are. Thank you.
Thank you. Move,
to finish off, okayed it without any authority. And the bosses came home from their summer holiday. Said, what's all this about? And he said, oh, well, we're doing it. He said, no, you're not. Clear off. So it was done at a low level without authorization. So we didn't actually have to turn it down.
But Tom got £25,000, I heard.
He was contracted, yes.
What did you feel when, what did you know about the fact that you went in without the doctor? Oh, was that the 50th anniversary?
What?
I didn't even know what it was called. Well, I mean, the thing is that I'm sure Colin will concur that over a year before the 50th anniversary, we actually thought we were going to be in it. Because everywhere we went in the world, people would say, oh, you're going to be in the 50th anniversary. And we thought that they would listen to the fans. But on the beginning of that year, we realised they haven't listened to the fans and we weren't going to be in it. So Peter Davison came up with this brilliant idea and wrote and directed and created this joyful piece of fun that we all had. And we had such fun, didn't we, Colin?
We did.
It was one of the best things we've been worked on for a long time. I asked them to turn it down. You can turn it out now.
I will differ from you slightly, because even though we assumed there might be that possibility, I was always doubtful, because I looked at myself in the mirror and held up one of those pictures that I autograph and thought, for me it doesn't work. I don't look the same. Out of respect, I mean, Peter is the only one who might have got away with it, with a bit of help from makeup and a bit of a toupee. But the rest of us have changed enormously. And you don't want to spend half an hour explaining why we look different. So I never genuinely thought we were likely to involve it.
But then they invited Tom and he looked totally different.
I thought that was, again, that was like the Dark Dimension. For a lot of people, the fourth Doctor, I don't mean Doctor Who fans, I mean the rest of the world, classic Who is Tom Baker.
Yeah.
For a lot of them. So if you're commercially minded, you stick Tom in for a cameo so that everybody goes, look, there's Tom Baker. Quite who he is and why he's there, we don't know. But it's nice to see Tom Baker. I just thought he was naff.
But they could have done like cameos and all
these. Right, diplomatic.
Right. I didn't say he was naff. All the idea was.
All right, okay.
On the topic of the private smokers, would you ever really like to take down Donald Trump and keep him in prison?
Yes. Actually, I read somewhere that the cast of Star Trek have all got together and put out a notice asking everyone not to vote for Hillary Clinton, to keep Trump out. And I was thinking we should do that, the doctors, if we... We should sign that. We should maybe all get together and just sign a little letter that we, encourage our fans in America to vote for Hillary Clinton and not Trump.
The only people in America who watch Doctor Who are the ones who would care what we said. And the people who watch Doctor Who in America are the same ones who will vote for Hillary Clinton.
You mean to say Doctor Who fans are sane?
That they live in a different world to the rednecks who are going to vote for.
All right. Okay.
In my opinion.
You might be right. But I met a few Doctor Hands and they've got guns as well.
Spoons.
Pardon?
It's spoons.
Yes. And you? You want me to play it now?
Yes.
Okay. Where are they? Oh, there they are. Yes, and I think the spoons. Colin, I know you hate this bit.
I'm quite happy I get arrested.
Have you not wanted to know with you?
But see there, here we are. Actually, could you come and help me, young lad? Could you come and help me, please? Because I need the microphone. Aaron?
War.
Can I call you Aaron?
Yes.
You call me Mr.
spoons. So would you hold that? Well, you got it, Marsh. Look at that. That's it. Okay. Right. And then so testing. Tuning up. Thing. Wait, come on, come on.
Carry on.
Who would I play? I might play the Master. I think I'd like to play the Master. That would be what I'd like to play.
What was like when you were in Doctor Who and when you met the Dumbledore for the first time?
It was great. Well, no, I don't know how to put this really, because it's the actor I met for the first time, Terry Molloy. He was a lovely man. So he's a marvellous actor, because as soon as he put himself in as the Emperor of the Daleks, he was really scary. But anyway, I gave him lots of rice pudding. So what about you, when you met the Davros? You met Davros, didn't you?
Yeah, Terry Molloy is fantastic. I still don't understand why they recast Davros, because the one they recast is pretty much exactly the same.
Yeah.
And Terry Molloy should have stayed as Davros. And my favourite Big Finish audios I do are the ones with Davros, because it's a bit like the Holmes and Moriarty thing. We haven't got the master that used to exist, the Delgado type master, who is the equal enemy of the Doctor. But Davros gets pretty close, and they've had some very clever ideas on Big Finish of how to pit Davros against the Doctor. So I've always enjoyed working with him that way. And I worked with him as an actor before he came on as Davros, because he was in
Attack
of Sandman, thank you very much. So I knew he was an actor before I did my first Davros story with him.
I worked with him years ago, 40 years ago, in Coventry Rep. We did three plays together.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he just started doing Of the Archers.
He's a good man.
Nice man, a really nice man. Great fun. Anyone else over here? Hands up. Oh, there's an umbrella up. I've always had a soft spot for an umbrella.
What's it like working with past doctors in Damaged in Time? It's only been special.
Terrible. That was a terrible experience, wasn't it? The Adventures in Time. I mean, it was great to see us all back, and I remember we were filming down by the Admiralty.
Oh, that was a bit the children need thing.
Yeah.
Oh.
Ooh, wasn't it bad? Anyway, we were filming down at the Admiralty, and what was exciting was, okay, we hadn't been out for a while, and suddenly there were builders repairing bits of the building, and then there was admirals hanging out windows going, oh, Doctor Who! And there was builders going, Doctor Who! And it was just so exciting, and people were so excited by seeing Doctor Who being made. And then it turned out to be this rubbish and EastEnders and whatever it was, Coronation Street, not as the other one.
My favourite was with the EastEnders lot. And they were lovely.
Oh, no, they were lovely. Everything was lovely.
It just was a misconceived idea.
Yeah.
And it was neither fish nor fowl, really.
Exactly, and JMT always wanted to direct EastEnders.
Bless him, he had many wonderful qualities, but there was a showbiz element that sometimes tripped him up. As long as you ignore it as part of the Doctor Who canon, then we're fine. Yeah. A bit of silly fun. But I got him.
Yeah.
Five-ish.
But that wasn't as much.
But we were playing ourselves.
Yeah. And we were very silly. So, the one nice
thing about Jordan Turner there, he wants to ask you a question.
It is, but I've got a story to tell about that, the Dimensions and Time or whatever it was. The one good thing about it was, I got to work with Lewis Jameson. Now, I'd always wanted to work with Lewis Jameson, and I had scenes with her. Now, they were using a special camera. It was a German camera, and it was supposed to be 3D. And how it worked was, it would only work if it was continuously moving. So it had to, the camera had to move, and you had to have three different kind of things in the way to give it the 3D effect. So Louise and I were standing, talking to each other, and this camera had a big, long cable, and the camera was going round us like that to make the 3D effect. But as it did so, it started to pull us together. And so there was I with Louise Jameson, and I was slowly being pulled towards her. I just didn't want that scene ever to end.
She has had a big talk with me as well. Without the cable.
All right. You lucky thing. Anyway, excuse me.
During the Great Show in the Galaxy,
fantasy when the asbestos problem happened. How hard was it to film?
Well, it wasn't. In a way, it was quite good, in the sense, because we actually filmed in a real tent. Originally, we were going to shoot in the studio, but the design because of the asbestos, they had to close the BBC down, the White City, and they took us to the set of EastEnders, and they put us on the car park, much to the EastEnders actors' annoyance. They put us in the car park and built a tent, and we did it there. The only problem is that sound was a big problem. Because every now and again, you know, the EastEnders actors would roar past to make us annoyed because we'd stolen the car park. And that was the only problem. But the rest of it was quite good, really, I think. Yeah. But anyone else, you can burn out. Oh, you're EastEnders.
Colin, sadly, in Pulse, your doctor saw us perform less well than others, I would say. But over the past few years, your doctor, I feel, has been redeemed and has become much more popular. How do you feel about that?
The trend is in the right direction. If it's the other way around, I'd be worried. If I was the most popular and now hated, then I probably wouldn't be sitting here. I'd be skulking at home. Yeah, of course it's. I mean, I have to say, Big Finish has given me the chance to give you who the Sixth Doctor is. And if I can't be judged on that, then I might as well give up. But I've loved what they've given me to do, and a proper regeneration, as opposed to what I was being offered when I was sacked. So what's your name again? So, yeah, I've said enough. Go on,
man. Okay, so you seem to be quite a good comedy double act, you two. I just wonder whether we've all missed out on a fabulous Two Doctors story with the two of you in, yeah. Or whether Big Finish could lock you in the TARDIS together for a few stories.
Well, I think we've done Big Finish ones, but yes. No, I think it would have been great if we could have done it. One. I mean, the five-ish doctors is the nearest you're going to get.
I thought the three of us worked together very well, actually.
Indeed.
Because there's three completely different sizes, shapes, personalities, and characters. Because even though we were playing ourselves, we weren't being ourselves, we were playing a kind of fictionalized version of ourselves that worked for that script. Because Peter isn't that kind of unsure. He's very confident, very sure. And I'm not that grumpy and bossy.
No, that's the best. No, you really nailed it.
And you're not that irritating.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
But that, if ever there was a kind of Three Stooges possibility, I mean, people have asked us if we would do another one, and I'm sure we might say I would.
Yeah.
Very happily. But there's two major problems. One, the first one was so good, in my opinion, and yours as well, from what I've heard, that you have to have something as good, if not better, to, you know, because nothing worse than a lame sequel. And secondly, that we did it for nothing. Most people who were involved in it did it for the love of the programme, and you can't do that twice. You can't get people to give all that time twice.
Ian McKellen, he cost $20 million, though.
So it would have to be crowdfunded. Now, I have no doubt that if we came up with the right idea, crowdfunding would be very possible.
Well, I thought we could try and break our way into Top Gear. Because, I mean, the casting would be absolutely perfect. You could be the grumpy one, you know.
So during your ears, both your ears, Josh, you have.
During our ears?
Ears. You both have very, very good guest stars. Are there any bit of a highlight in particular when they came on?
Colin.
Was I your favourite?
Yes.
Yes. No. You see me as a guest star now, do you?
I guess I do. No, the thing is, I guest starred on yours. I was the one
time it with, you know, you were
so I took your role.
They said, how can we, who can we get that would come up to the stature of Colin Baker? And he came up with me.
It's an easy for you.
But who would you
guest stars? The one that whose performance I liked, the one that, I mean, there was a scene I did with Morris Denham, and I loved him. Do you remember Morris Denham in the very first story? And I thought that last moment with Morris Denham was one of the bits of Doctor Who that, you know, if you asked me to single out clips, that would be a bit. He was a smashing actor. Who else did? Of course, O'Brien. I did do O'Brien, bless him. Yes, I'd like to be Brian Blessed.
Well, Richard Briers, I remember, with great affection, he did one, and we couldn't do the scenes for laughing. We just laughed all the way through the whole episodes. It was great. And he said the nicest thing to me, he said, ah, you're one of us. And I thought, great. Imagine being one of, you know, friends of Richard Briers. So that was the one that I remember. There's many others, many great ones.
Ken Dodd.
Ah, this is one. Yes, that was terrific. That was also sad, really. There was something, we were filming outdoors, it was overnight, and Ken arrived and he said, there's a guy over there who knows all about Ken Dodd. Anyway, he arrived and he said, I don't know what to do, tell me what to do. You know, and he was very humble. And we filmed over the night, and there was outside broadcasting vans. It was all done on video. So there's big vans out there. The director and the producer were in the vans looking at the screen, and Ken Dodd was doing his stuff. Now, he was very funny when the people were getting onto the bus. He made all sorts of cracks, which they didn't use. They were just incredibly funny. And the people who were getting on the bus were just pissing themselves laughing. It was so funny. Then the baddies arrived. I forgot what they're called, but they arrived. The Bannerman arrived, and then they captured him. Now, Ken was going, ha ha, oh no, ah, oh no, oh no, oh no, oh no, oh no, something like that. And I was sitting in the van with the director and the producer, and they were going, what is he doing? And I thought, well, why don't you tell him? I mean, because he has, you know, that's his job, he's in, this is what I do. But he also did play an amazingly good Malvolio, I heard, you know, in Liverpool once. And so I was sitting there, but the thing is, I can't go tell Ken Dodd how to do it. I'm an actor. But all they had to do was, you know, just go up to him and say, Ken, imagine you're in the Palladium, and the IRA arrived, because it was at that time. This is how you do it that way, this is for real. But no, they just sat there criticising him, and then when they come out, most of the plays, that was a really disappointing thing. I felt very sad about that, really. But anyway, that was nice working with him, though. No one else, okay, come on.
Freedom!
If there's any current television show that either of you like to guest star in that you think is really interesting
and
you'd like to be a part of?
I'd love to be
Once Upon a Time. Is that what you asked?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd love Once Upon a Time. You've been all quiet on me.
What is it?
What's Once Upon a Time? It's a very good television series.
Isn't it?
Who's in it? Nobody you'd heard of, probably.
But I know what I can remember.
Lana Perilla. Rebecca Vega. No?
Are they American?
Yeah.
Alright. Or?
Stranger Things. Oh. Anyone seen that?
No.
Wouldn't mind being in that. That's on Netflix. I got to be Corrie, because I come from Rochdale, and that was my accent as a child. Right. What would you like to be?
The news.
Just done a show for Netflix, haven't you?
Oh yeah,
Sense8.
Yes.
What is that?
familiar with that.
Is that about lots of people taking their clothes off and bringing it around and having a good old time?
Including you.
Overrun, but I was loathed to end such a joyous panel, to be honest. It's been fantastic from start to finish, and I think the sign for me of a good panel is when the interviewer has to ask a few questions. Thank you so much.
And when the interviewee is crying.
I was granted a short interview with Colin Baker, but I was quite keen to see if I could jog his memory, which doesn't appear to be particularly good at the moment, about the time he met Kirby. And I thought the thing that would really jog his memory was the name Kirby itself. And Kirby insisted that Colin does actually remember him. And fortunately, judging by this probably badly conducted interview, it didn't seem to be so. In the southern states of America, and you spent a bit of time with Kirby Bartlett Sloan. And I thought we might do that. But, at the time, the name stuck in mind because one, it was a girl's name, and he's a bloke, and it reminded you of something to do with the Kirby wire. Are you looking blankly at me? Because I'm pretty sure.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
And there was a comment where the commercial was either one called Conquistor, is it in Huntsville, Alabama?
I certainly went to Huntsville, Alabama.
Yeah, that's probably that.
But NGT. You have to understand that doing a podcast for me is something I do
quite a lot,
and then go and do a lot of others.
Yes.
So what was on them and who I was talking to?
Yeah.
Sadly,
this is what I thought might happen.
A mere ripple in the ocean of time.
In a way, it makes me so happy because I like to wind him up about such things. Now, if you felt awkward listening to that, just imagine how awkward I felt actually conducting the interview. What Colin doesn't know that Kirby is, of course, a complete and utter legend. And that's that. Sorry, Kirby, but it was Colin, not me. Should have perhaps interviewed Sylvester about him, maybe, I don't know. Are you starting to feel like you're actually at the event? Because this show is going on a bit, but I'm hoping you're enjoying it, because it's still going to go on still further. I did have a chance to interview the chap that supplied the convention with a TARDIS. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Not a problem. My name is Paul Adger.
And what's your sort of part in this particular convention?
My part in this particular convention is slightly twofold. One, the prop supplier for the event. Mm-hmm. So the TARDIS, one of the Daleks is down to me, and I've organised the two Daleks. Mm-hmm. And the other one is I'm selling some toys.
Oh, excellent. So that's a bit of a two-way thing there.
It is indeed. One thing tries to pay for the other.
Is this something you do quite a lot in the convention circuit, supplying props and things?
Yes, we've supplied props to quite a few events. I think we're down to scheduled to supply some stuff to Edinburgh for next year.
Yes.
We tend not to go too far, mm-hmm. purely because they're quite bulky. It gets quite expensive to transport.
Yeah.
And there are Daleks and TARDISes at the end of the country.
Yeah.
We're the northeast one.
Yeah. So have you got more props other than the magnificent TARDIS and even more magnificent Dalek? Have you got more things? Say if it's a bigger hall, would you have more things to put in it?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
We have not just Doctor Who, but we've got some Star Wars, some Star Trek.
Yeah.
Doctor Who-wise, we've got several versions of Cyberman, Cassandra, K-9, Davros.
Somewhere you can actually open up a sort of museum of the stuff you've got.
We have lent some stuff to travel.
Yeah,
to
I thought you might. So what's your favourite piece of what you have amongst your repertoire of props?
My favourite piece is probably the K-9. So I made it. All the props are made by me anyway.
Oh, right. Wow.
But K-9 I had quite a long time, and I've always had a soft spot for K-9.
Yeah.
And he's very small.
Yeah.
He fits somewhere. You can hide him.
Oh, right.
The Dalek tends to take up lots of storage. The TARDIS takes up lots of storage. K-9, not so much.
I take it that's dismantleable. That
it is. It's a flat-pack IKEA-style TARDIS, yes.
Wow, that's really, really good. And you've made that all yourself. How much does it take to build something like that?
To build or to put up?
I mean, did it come to you in the flat pack thing? No,
completely built by me. It's actually the second one I've done.
Yeah.
The first one I've done, did a few conventions, was used in the Power of the Daleks reimagined fan film.
Right.
Which I believe is now not available on YouTube anymore.
I think I've seen that.
It's strange copyright reasons and something else that might be coming up soon.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense in some ways.
But yes, that was done purely as a convention piece, a transportable TARDIS.
Yeah.
So there's a couple of little liberties with the design, but by and large it's a Paul McGann TARDIS that Dropbox done it with a car.
So, very impressive.
Thank you.
Built from scratch.
That one took about 6 weeks of spare time to build.
Really good going, actually.
It takes about an hour and a half to put up. Down can be 15 minutes, it depends on when there's a paint on the corner.
Yeah. What about Daleks? How long have they taken it together?
To build, probably doing it in about 4 weeks now.
Wow. You run some sort of factory there. Well, there's probably a massive demand for things like Daleks and. And TARDIS, as I would have thought, but.
There's possibly less demand than there was a couple of years ago. And to be fair, it's a lot easier now to go and buy yourself a Dalek.
Yeah, and the idea also to knit them.
But no, I mean, the fact that you can now go on the internet and buy a part of a Dalek, you can buy a Dalek dome, it's certainly a lot easier now to own your own Dalek than it was sort of 8-9 years ago when that one was built.
Yeah. I like to own one, but I've got no room for one in my house. Unless I stick it in the garden, maybe. Might keep the fox away.
It's when people see the props to go, wow, you must be an absolutely massive Doctor Who fan. I'd love to see your house. Well, no, you wouldn't, because there's virtually nothing Doctor Who hit. Where do you keep your TARDIS? It's flat packed around my wife's Cortina in the garage. Oh, what about the Dalek? Hang on, where is it now? It's in my mate's pub, or it's up there, in the other garage.
Yeah.
So, whilst I enjoy them, and they're lovely to make, it can be a bit of a nightmare to store, and a bit of a nightmare to use, and they do tend to pick up the odd little bit of damage at these events.
Yeah. Which is difficult to repair, I would imagine.
Not difficult, it can just get quite expensive.
No, okay. Does that come into, if you're wiring something out like that, do you incorporate some sort of insurance charge into the possibility of it getting damaged?
To be perfectly honest, we don't really hire them out. What we will do is we will charge a donation to charity normally transporting costs.
Yeah.
We may well factor in the paint and the transporting costs.
Okay.
But strictly speaking, we don't actually provide Daleks to hire.
Okay. I suppose you can, really. The BBC are getting across it, don't they?
Indeed. Yes. But apart from this, we also organise events.
Yes.
We've got an event coming up in Washington at Nissan. The 4th of December called Geekdom.
Not Washington in America, obviously.
No. nice and local. Washington time, we are.
Yeah.
As William Hartnell might say, the original dear boy.
Yeah.
But yes, we've got we will have almost our full repertoire of props should be there.
Wow.
So we've got a Captain Kirk chair from the original Enterprise replica.
Yep.
As well as the TARDIS.
Is it better than the one that's currently on in Birmingham, the Shatner sat in this afternoon?
I don't know, I haven't seen those. But
notice the way I said that. That could have come out completely wrong there.
It almost
Shatner
did.
Never mind.
If that's a tongue twister, don't use it on
Shatner
the radio.
Satin.
I like it. It's pretty much the thing you want. And once we're off the air, I'll show you a photograph.
Cool. And I'll show you a picture of Shatner in the...
Excellent.
In the one at Birmingham. But yes, thank you. Thank you very much.
And we've got some Who Gets coming up.
Time.
It's called Geekdom.
Yeah, you plug away. Anything else?
I'll just plug it. If you look on the Facebook or the website, you'll see what guests we've got booked up.
Have you already mentioned your Facebook page and your website for the listeners?
I probably haven't. The Facebook page is the Geekdom event. At Geekdom Events, apparently, according to this flyer that I'm reading, because my wife does most of it. And we are the Funky Patch.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me.
During the Saturday, there was an auction for charity, and Help the Heroes appeared to be the charity of choice for the whole of the event. I contributed by buying a signed print of Deborah Watling. Beautiful thing, actually. Cost me a fiver. Quite happy to donate a fiver. And I also donated one of the prints that I was given as part of my gold ticket. We got a selection of prints signed by the actual actors themselves. So that was really nice. One of the guests, well, not guests, one of the minions like myself, made a point of collecting signed stuff that he's going to auction to
make money for Help the Heroes.
Okay, you'd like to introduce yourself?
My name's Phil Hogarth.
And what do you hear at the convention for, apart from obviously the fun of it all?
Well, apart from getting a couple of autographs for myself and meeting up with old friends, I'm here mainly to get autographs on items for a charity auction raffle I'm holding myself in aid of Help the Heroes.
And where and when would this auction be?
The event is at the Future in Bristol, the 19th and 20th of November. It's called Pandorica, run by Phantom Films.
And how much have you sort of raised to date on that particular thing?
Well, I never used to keep a record on how much I was raising for Help for Heroes. I've been kind of like a keen supporter for about 3 years, and I started keeping a record last year when I set up an account called Time for Heroes at Barclays, where all the money gets transferred through. It's kind of like my full-time thing now. With being unable to work, I needed a reason for getting up in the morning, and I'm estimating, I would say ballpark figures over the last 3 years, maybe about 15,000.
That's lovely. I've noticed there are people making donations to you, obviously, of artworks and signings and things like that for the raffle and the auction and stuff. And that's gone rather well, hasn't it?
Yes, people have been very kind. I mean, three attendees here have given me their autograph sheets to allow me to get extra items signed. Richard Young, the artist here, has donated original artworks, which have been signed by the necessary celebrities. So it is looking a very good possibility of a fantastic target next month. And I'd just like to say my local Barclays are match funding the event, Barclays in Longton in Stoke-on-Trent, and they're going to match everything I make for the charity up to £1,000.
Well, that's rather good, isn't it?
Yes, I'm really pleased.
Well, I'd like to donate this this signed picture of Lauren. Who is it, Lauren?
It's Lauren Wilson from Family of Blood.
And hope that helps towards your cause.
It certainly does. And thank you very much indeed.
If you just remind listeners where and when, if they wanted to attend this event.
Yes, it's a Phantom Films event. It's called Pandorica at the Future Inn in November, in Bristol in November, 19th and 20th of November. And tickets, I believe, are still available, but they are in very short supply.
Where can they get the tickets from?
Just go to the Phantom Films website.
Okay. Thank you very much.
One of the highlights of the Saturday evening for me personally was the celebrity dinner. It was a present for me from my mother, and thanks, Mum. Basically, we were waiting to go in. Everybody else got dressed up in very posh gear. Of course, I was there with my jeans and T-shirt. I didn't have anything posh to wear because I had a very small bag to get on the plane. But I noticed a few others in there also had this similar style, so wasn't too bad when I got in there. We didn't know who we were going to get on our table. I was very lucky to sit down and find I'm sat next to Matthew Waterhouse, who didn't look as pleased as me, the fact that I was sat next to him. I did ask him actually at the time if I could have an interview later in the week. He sort of said yes and then changed his mind on the Sunday. Also on the table was a very chatty bald man who tipped me a glass of wine, and I thought, what a nice man he is. And then later on, found out that he was actually John Davey, the regular monster player on Doctor Who. He was very keen to give me an interview, and I was very glad to take it.
And I'm now with John Davey, who is a bit of a superstar in the world of Doctor Who, because he's been in more episodes than Sylvester McCoy. No, that's right. It was Sylvester McCoy. I was going to say Christopher Eccleston, Peter Capaldi, Matt Smith. Maybe I'll add Tennant in there, but if you combine all those actors together, you've probably been in more episodes than all of them.
Yeah, well, to date on screen, I've been in 38 episodes of Doctor Who. I started back in Series 2 with the four Cybermen episodes, and I have then gone on to play pretty much most of the other monsters since, namely the Ood, Jadoon, Half, Heavenly Host, Maya, Daleks,
Shansheeth Hand.
We'll probably get back to that one because that is quite a funny story. Yeah.
So yeah, how did you end up, you know, first getting into to the world of Doctor Who?
I went for an audition. Wasn't told what it was for. And there was 50 guys, all similar height and build. And we spent a day at the BBC studios in Cardiff. marching around, walking around with our eyes closed, spatial awareness, and we were being coached by Elsa Burke, who is the choreographer for Doctor Who. And at the end of that day, we were then told that it was an audition to be the Cybermen on Doctor Who. Then we were told, and by the way, you're not allowed to tell anyone. So that was fantastic. And it was, being a fan of Doctor Who and watching it as a child, I was like, oh my goodness, this is just absolutely amazing.
Yes.
We then had another audition and then went to Millennium Effects that make most of the creature monsters for Doctor Who to actually try on the suit. And if it fit and if you were happy being encased in a fiberglass helmet, then we got picked. And then spent about 35 days over a couple of months shooting the 4 Cybermen episodes in series 2. After that had finished, I thought, wow, that is an amazing life experience. Little did I know that 10 years later, and I'll still be doing it, yeah.
You're obviously very good at it, and I must like you a lot.
I don't complain, I put the suit on and I get coached very well.
And
hit my mark. So it's good. It's a real honour to be still working on the show after all that time.
And now, obviously, we get to see your face as well on several episodes. Because obviously, sometimes you're behind a mask or a suit, but quite often we get to see the real you.
Yes. It's a few times my face has popped on to screen. I think the first time was the Sultaran Stratagem, and I was an Atmos worker in a corridor, and I had one of the greatest lines in television. I was stood by a door, and the door opens, and my line is, "It's open." So, Oscar-winning performance there. And then I've been a unit soldier a couple of times. Most recently, Death in Heaven, where I'm on the aeroplane with Missy, and she turns around and vaporizes us. And also the Zygon Inversion, where I'm a policeman in a police car having a bit of a staring contest with the Doctor.
So, what's your sort of favourite experience, or say you're going to be today, what sort of thing you think, oh great, I really like doing that one?
Well, normally if it's a comfortable costume, that'll be quite good, but I'm not sure whatever I get given I have great fun doing. I think last year the Maya Warriors was an amazing costume. Just the sheer scale of it just looks so impressive. And
is
I've done
the
quite
Maya one, is that what story was that one in?
The Girl Who Died.
Now that one, I think my daughter's actually had that helmet on, because at the Doctor Who festival they had an array of...
Oh, well, she would have actually seen me, because I was stood there with the helmet.
You may well have put it on her head.
Yeah, I probably did put it on her head. So that was an amazing experience. Actually doing live events, and I got to be the Maya, and I walked up on stage and the talk with Mark Gatiss and Kate Walsh, and then they unhelmeted me.
Just doing a creaky, a sneaky in interview shot.
And it was great. And then basically all the fans could come and have a play and touch and try on the Ood masks. Yeah. So
did
having
you notice? Like, I did. But when they call it the Silurian masks, the people were putting them on, but back to front.
Yes.
We were all laughing about that at the time. God, they got it on.
Yeah, it kind of does fit the other way. It's kind of a bit like the Liberator spaceship as well. If you don't know, you probably think that that's back to front.
I'll tell you what must be really hard when you're actually involved in production of Doctor Who is keeping it a secret for people. I know it's something you're probably used to doing.
Yeah.
It must be quite, it must be itching people, because Doctor Who fans tend to like to guess what's going to happen. And if it does happen when they've guessed it, they get all excited. Oh, I said that was going to happen. So you must get that all the time. They sort of, it's quite,
It is quite funny looking at people's comments on Instagram and Facebook when normally they sneak out a few images and people generally overthink and sort of write all of this subtext over this picture, and I'm like, and it's funny because I'm just going, no, it's not that, but they carry on, and you know, it's all good, it's all good fun.
Yeah, of course, you can never say yes, even if it's not.
No, exactly.
No, that's great. Yeah, well, thanks very much. It was a great meal there last night, wasn't it?
Oh, it was. Yeah, it was. Enjoyed that. Absolutely amazing.
But yeah, thank you. It's been lovely meeting you, John. Well, thank you for your time.
Cool. No worries.
That was one of the highlights of my weekend. But unfortunately, I neglected the chance to get a signed photo of him, but instead got a photo with him rather sneakily with my phone, which was, in my view, much better. Very nice man. Later on Sunday, I was absolutely thrilled to get the opportunity to speak to Richard Franklin. Again, these people are really nice. I was hoping to get a shout and a chat with, because it was going to be a shout with John Levine. He's a very loud man. But John left early. Not before I managed to get my picture taken with him and Richard Franklin. Richard sort of did a bumper for the show, but forgot to mention the name of the show, so we won't be using it. But here he is anyway.
Yeah, Richard. All our listeners have been watching every story and episode from the beginning, so we've just finished the Patrick Troughton era, and we're about to embark on the John Pertwee era.
Oh, now you get into the classic series.
Yes. Now, just imagine that they've never seen it before. What would you say to people who are about to experience the John Pertwee era? What treats they're about to come up with?
Now, the treats that you're about to come up with when you listen to the Doctor Who John Pertwee series, first of all, very good writing, very good stories that will grip you, and you will want to know what happens. You won't be able to wait patiently till the following week when you get another episode. It's all cliffhangers. Some of the episodes are 4 episodes and others are 6. And the thing about the John Pertwee era, which I think was extremely good, is that it happens on Earth. And although obviously it's science fiction, and the universe, well, you have to, because after all, the Doctor and the Master are both Time Lords, and they have 2 hearts, and they are able to do all sorts of amazing things with their TARDIS. But apart from that, if these the evil master brings people down from wherever, some distant planet, and then lands on Earth, that's a pretty scary situation. Mm. And when they try to influence the evil elements on Earth, that combination of 2 lots of evil, outer space and definitely your next door neighbour, you'll be scared.
And of course, it was something new in Doctor Who for that era was the fact that it was a team of a cast that was kept together for 5 years, of which of course you were heavily
Yes,
involved
absolutely. In. I mean, there were 6 of us who were involved. There were the Doctor and the Master, who of course represent good and evil. And John Pertwee's good was quite a maverick sort of good. And then you've got the unit, which was the United Nations Intelligence Task Force, which came in to help the Doctor and advise him at crucial moments. And the unit was composed, first of all, of course, of Katie Manning, who was a technical assistant and very much the assistant of John Pertwee. And then you have Brigadier, Sergeant and Captain. I mention that order because, of course, the Captain is superior to the Sergeant. But as I am giving you the interview, I would naturally put the Sergeant first. And we were very good friends and also we were a good fighting unit. The Brigadier with his moustache, a bumbly old Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart, Katie Manning, the girl for whom I, as the captain, had a love interest.
Yeah.
I, of course, was Captain Mike Yates, and Sergeant Benton, who was the action man of the piece.
Also, your character in particular had quite a journey, didn't he? Because I think he came into the second series of John Pertwee and went through quite a few ups and downs. And there was a big down in the dinosaur story. And I thought, at the time, I was really young when I watched it, I thought that was it for Mike Yates.
Yes.
And he came back for the finale.
Well, yes. I mean, that is perfectly true. The character of Mike Yates had a very nice character development because he went through a misguided period in his life. He also was greatly influenced by the Metabilis Sapphire, which didn't do him any good.
No, didn't do the doctor any good either.
No, it didn't do anyone any good. It was a very powerful stone from Metabilis. But so that's nice for an actor to portray somebody who has these different sides to his character. It wasn't a straight line. When Mike Yates eventually left the Planet of the Spiders, he buzzed off. He was thinking into retirement, but he actually buzzed off into another story called Operation Hate, which the whole of Unit was involved. Operation Hate has been published by Phantom Films Limited, and if you catch up with me at a convention, particularly Dimensions, then we will have you'll be able to look at, perhaps even buy a copy.
Okay, thank you very much, Richard.
Yeah, not at all.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Now, earlier on, we were having great fun with Chris Thompson's impressions, and I did promise we'd go back to him later on, so I wanted to actually hear a bit of the real Chris, and this is it. Okay, I'd like to introduce yourself as yourself this time.
Yeah, hello, I'm Christopher Thompson.
And what's your link? Obviously, you do voice and stuff. You're an actor.
I am, yeah.
And are you doing anything at the moment?
I'm doing an audiobook for someone at the moment called City of the Gods. Other than that, I'm doing some sort of projects on my own. I'm doing a series of Patrick Troughton audio dramas.
Okay.
And we've done three about 2 years ago, and we're doing two more this year.
Have you done anything that the viewers and or listeners may have already seen that might not be available anymore?
I'm not sure. I don't
video type stuff?
I have a lot of things on my YouTube. We did a first Doctor meets second Doctor thing. A multi-Doctor adventure at Christmas we did. All the audio dramas we have are all still available to listen to.
And where can they find those dramas?
Every link should be on my website, which is mrcthompson.com. Yeah, they're all on there. I've been on the fan show a couple of times. So that was nice. Interviewed about the audio dramas, and another occasion I played a sort of sketch character for a couple of them, and that was which was fun, which was very fun.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for talking to me.
No problem. Thank you.
Sunday was a great day for those of us who are enjoying the photo shoots. It was also the day we had some of the Earthshock cast with us, which was Claire, Matthew and Sarah. So I really did enjoy getting pictures with them and tried to have a bit of fun with it, but a couple of the people in the pictures, if you see on the Facebook page, weren't quite paying attention to what we were trying to achieve with it. But as the Sunday went on, it went a lot quieter and the celebrities just sat there at the tables. They'd signed all the autographs, so they had a bit of time on their hands, probably getting a little bit tired. I was very lucky to have the opportunity to chat to this lady.
I can't remember.
Yes, I'm very lucky to be here with the very lovely Sarah Sutton, who doesn't know that...
her name.
But when I became a fan of Doctor Who, the episode that kicked me into fandom.
Was it?
It was.
Okay.
Simply because it was such a fascinating thing, seeing the regeneration of Tom Baker into Peter Davis.
So how old were you at that point?
Did you get a registration card? I was still at school, so 15.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Of course, you were heavily involved in that part of Doctor Who, and I still find it really fascinating now, sort of going through those stories of Keeper of Truk and that trilogy and your time in the show. And obviously it's quite a long time ago now, but it comes back to haunt you.
Yes, just a few years. Yes, it's never to be forgotten, that's for sure.
But it comes back to haunt you in a positive way.
Yes, it does, because we get to do conventions and all the fans are great, but they remember so much more. They know so much more than I do, and I can remember and I have to rack my brains. But I was certainly very lucky to be involved in a Doctor's Regeneration stuff.
Yes. It's very iconic, isn't it, if you watch that back. So that's the clip a lot of people see, and you all gathered around the Doctor and go, Doctor!
Doctor!
And then I think must have been really shocked, because they're saying a slightly different sort of context in the first episode, the Castrovalva episode. It's slightly different. But, of course, I have to say that, obviously, being a teenager, there were two very attractive companions. The Doctor was probably something that prevents me being interested in the show. And, of course, your sort of garments sort of went from down here, and they gradually...
Yes, they got less and less. And less.
The washing machine had some effect on the height of them, didn't they?
The velvet trousers were wonderful for location filming, though, because if it was cold and everything, they were warm, and I used to feel very sorry for Janet with her. When we filmed Time Flight,
her boot tube was always a problem, wasn't it?
The roof of the Terminal 3 car park at Heathrow, when it was snowing. She was absolutely frozen. So sorry. But in the end, I ended up with clothes shrinking all over the place as well, so I shouldn't have felt so smug.
Yeah, sad day when. But the story you left in, the Terminus, is quite a powerful sort of the idea of these people, these lepers, and in space.
Lisa was going to stay there and sort them all out. She's still out there somewhere.
Is that your departure? Is that something you decided to do?
No, it was decided.
The fools.
Well, rumour has it that Peter did decide to speak in my corner to the production team, saying that he didn't think Nessa should go, but it fell on deaf ears, I'm afraid.
It's such a strange sort of alien to be in the centre of that story as well. I seem to remember that whatever the alien was.
Gorm,
was it?
Gorm.
Yeah. Weird.
That big hairy dog thing.
Yeah. At least Nessa returns, doesn't she?
Well, yes. She returns in Big Finish, so that's excellent. And I've been very lucky with Big Finish. I've had two sort of themes going on, where it's been old Nessa and new Nessa, and then old Nessa looked young, and now old Nessa's been parked somewhere in a different dimension, so she's kind of out of the picture at the moment. So.
Well, you're also very lucky, your voice hasn't changed much in the time, so.
Well, I think it has, all our voices have changed.
Don't get that from the audios now, especially with Colin Baker, because he sounds exactly the same, and it shouldn't do. So, we've obviously looked after your vocal cords quite well.
I don't know, I think we've all deepened a little bit.
Just be an acting thing. You're able to just make people. Or maybe they do something that you did.
I don't actually actively try and make my voice younger or lighter, but maybe it happens naturally when you're in the studio and you're with the Doctor and the other characters. It happens naturally without you thinking about it a bit, maybe. Which is good.
Do you enjoy the conventions?
Sorry?
Do you enjoy the convention?
Yes. I find I get quite tired of getting old now. Mm. So I quite like just coming and doing the day.
Yeah.
I'm quite happy doing the day. Yeah. So that's why I don't go to the States very much now, because it's 3 days.
Mm. Big journey, is it, as well?
Yeah. I'd rather just spend two collections here and keep me happy.
Well, thank you for coming to this one, because you made my day.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
So continuing the Earthshot theme, minus Matthew, as I said, who refused to do an interview with me. Clef Clifford, who of course has gone on to greater things since her appearance in Earthshock, especially the fact that she was able to appear on this show. I'm very lucky now to be here with Claire Clifford.
Hello.
Who was, you're in Earthshock.
Earthshock.
We did a photo, an Earthshock photo earlier on, which was great fun. That was one of your first acting jobs, wasn't it?
Well, it was after quite a long stint in Angels, which was
sort of the first.
Oh, there you go. See, she's Shirley Brent.
An older character in Angels, but you seem quite sort of...
I was the bossy one who became a staff nurse, Shirley Brent.
The one with the two stripes.
And the others all thought I was a very, played by the book and everything. So she didn't have many friends. She was a bit lonely.
Julie Dawn.
Julie Dawn. I saw her the other day. Yeah, Leslie Dunlop.
Yeah. Oh, yes, yeah. Of course she was in it.
Yeah, Erin Geraghty, who's usually in a play somewhere in the country. I'll give her a, because she's in a play right now. I'll give her a plug, because she's always working in theatre. Marvellous. Yeah, but so then John Nathan Turner had worked on Angels as a
floor manager.
Yeah. Yes. And then, of course, he magically took over Doctor Who and offered me the paleontologist Professor Kyle. Mm. Yes.
Very young professor.
That was about 2 years after I finished Angels.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tom, when the older you get, the shorter time seems, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, obviously they killed you off, which is a bit of a shame.
Yes.
Potential companion material, I would have thought.
Oh, and one thing I forgot to mention in any of the talks this
weekend, this is an exclusive,
is, of course, we broke the rules of the world by having somebody die in the TARDIS, because you're not supposed to be able to die in the TARDIS. And I don't think anybody's ever made enough fuss about
that. Yes, of course, the firing of weapons and stuff,
Yeah,
there was a name for that. I'll have to look it up. One of our presenters, Kirby, will know term is used for this.
Right. Well, if you could point that out.
Taken over the show. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So, obviously, you've gone on to bigger and better things. Not necessarily better things, as Doctor Who is the best thing.
Other things, exactly. Certainly a high point, yeah.
What's the most recent thing
I was at the National Theatre last year in Man and Superman with Ray Fiennes. So that took up most of last year. Who is marvellous. And that was wonderfully good fun, because I love the National, because I was there actually just after I did Doctor Who. I then went on to 2 years at the National back in the 80s and toured with them two or three years ago, and then Man of Superman last year. So that I'm equally happy on stage or TV. They both have their qualities. Theatre's where I started, so the smell of the stage door never quite leaves you.
And you're still doing Doctor Who conventions.
Yeah. You bet I am.
Excellent.
Yeah, I love them.
Very much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. Thank
you. We're nearly there, listeners. Thank you for sticking with us, but I hope you appreciate that I really couldn't make this show any shorter than it ended up being, because I would have cut out something quite interesting. And I really do hope that you've all found this really entertaining, really interesting. And the new people that come in, please, they're not normally quite as long as this, normally 2 hours at the most, but it was such a great weekend, and I really wanted to encapsulate that and show you what I had. There's lots of stuff I didn't record, by the way. So, but these were the highlights. And the last thing I'm going to play you is a Lee John interview. Everybody knows who Lee John is, don't they? Well, you'll know when you start listening to this. Next week, we're back to the normal 20 megabyte podcast. I'll have my buddies back, and I hope they've been swatting up on Spearhead from Space as we embark on the John Pertwee era. So I'll say goodbye to you, and I'll leave you with this interview that I was very lucky and privileged to have with Lee John. Thank you. Goodbye. Okay, it's an added bonus to be sat here with Lee John.
Hello, Lee. Good afternoon.
Enlightenment.
Yes.
You've forgiven me enlightenment? No. when enlightenment was on, of course, you were at the height of a pop fame at the time.
Yeah,
so it was
we had Music and Lights with my group Imagination.
Yes.
It was our second album. Mm-hmm. It'd gone platinum. Music and Lights was number 5. Before it was Body Talking and Out of Love, Flashback, Changes, Illusion.
Cool.
There's quite a lot of hits.
An Illusion with the best bass line ever.
Hey.
And probably, the track that everybody remembers.
Iconic.
Just listed a load of songs that are, all equally for me as well. No, because that was my period. That's when I was going to clubs and stuff like that.
Weren't we all?
Yes. Because it was quite unusual in those days to have somebody in a sort of pop based career appear.
Not really, because you had in the States, I would say. I think for British.
Britain, yeah.
Yeah, in America you always found, pop stars going into acting and stuff like that, and going, it was not the unusual thing. But Jonathan Turner, basically, we were in a bar, and he basically, not the bar, the BBC bar, I should say. That's the difference. Any bar is a difference.
Yeah.
We just did Top of the Pops, and we were in. It's a long day. We'd done 3 or 4 rehearsals, then we did the final shoot and everything, and it gets about 8 o'clock. So there we are upstairs in the BBC bar. My manager Brian Longley was sitting there, and Mr. Nathan Turner came in, and the next thing we know, they're asking me whether I'd like to be on Doctor Who. And then I remember Brian said, oh, he'll do it, don't worry about that. I said, but what am I doing? What's it all about? You know, and he said, Doctor Who. I thought, oh, Doctor Who, wow, you know. Yeah. And they said, no, you'd be fantastic, you'd be great. You know, there's like building my ego. And I was thinking, oh my God. It was like,
Have you done acting before? Oh, yes, but
not Doctor Who. No. Like, you know, basically, some of the actors are on Doctor Who, like, you know, they've done Macbeth, they've done Hamlet, you know what I'm saying? You're dealing with that level of degree of actors, you know. And I was at Anna Shear's theatre school. I was part of the Funeral Australian Players. I'd done acting as a kid in the States, and you know, learning my craft really, but not to the level that I was consistently doing it. So I had done The Chinese Detective prior to having Body Talk on Top of the Pops with the crew. So doing Doctor Who was like, wow, the most amazing outing that I could do as far as, you know, being in TV. Mm. But being part of a legacy, you know, a complete legacy. I grew up with William Hartnell and Patrick, and it's just overwhelming just to say, wow, I was in Doctor Who. And it's not until I did it actually come back, you know, did I feel, wow, I've done something really, you know, you don't think about it at the time.
Quite so important much, in history, yeah.
And at that time, my schedules were really busy, so I was doing it, you know, rehearsing it, then filming it, and then going off to do a show or going into the studio. So it was consistent. There was a lot of
do that thing when you're young, don't you? Yeah,
and I was also preparing to host the Disco Dancing Championship show for Channel 4 as well, which we did in the summer. So all that was going on. Well,
Channel 4 must have just launched in those days.
It just launched, and so it was all that. It was a very exciting period creatively, and I think also for the episode of Enlightenment, it was very creative because it was the first time they'd used things like the ships in the sky and some of the technical things that they were doing. Mm. And Peter Davison was very action-packed. He was probably one of the first action-type, you know, really actors doing it. And I think he identified a lot with the youth because he had that youthful appearance as well, the blonde hair.
Yeah, of course,
He had that, and it wasn't so much like some of the other doctors where it was more gimmicky and stuff like that. He had more of a natural kind of organic feel, I felt.
Of course, your character is quite sinister, wasn't he?
I was a space pirate.
Quite sort of camp, but sinister, both at the same time. So it was quite a clever combination to achieve sinisterness and camp.
Well, I felt like I was in those boots I was wearing. I felt a bit like an Elizabethan actor or something, or you know, an orator of some sort, because it was very much like we were on this ship, and the ship's sailing, and it's a game that we're actually playing.
Yeah.
And if I remember rightly, Linda Barron was my captain.
She was funny, wasn't she?
And she was very captain. So we played off each other. So, you know, it's like when if you're speaking French to somebody or you're speaking Spanish to somebody, you know, you kind of imitate how they're doing it, you know. You know. And so she would be speaking to me in a particular sort of a tone, and I would reply back in the same sort of tone. Mm. So we had this sort of...
Yeah, what's sinister about it is because you were really quite evil and sort of mean, but we were all talking very calm voices, and that sort of adds a level of sinisterism
to it, doesn't it? You know, do you think that he's going to be...
Sort of smirk on your face.
Yeah, very smirking. But we're all very nice and talking like that. That kind of evil sort of thing. But I love being a villain anyway.
Literally cutthroat, because there was a scene in which you sort of come up behind with the knife
with
around.
With the sword and stuff. Yeah, bloody hell. That's going way back. Wow.
So they released another version of it, didn't they? Fiona Cumming. She was a director, wasn't she?
Yes, she was.
And there was a director's cut version. That's right. Like a full-length movie version, which is on one of the DVDs.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I haven't seen it.
I don't know if it's been slightly...
I did the making of, but I haven't seen the director's cut. I'm funny that way. I don't really watch myself at all. Very, very rarely. Like, people say, oh, you're on Top of the Pops. Once I've done it and that's it, I kind of see a little glimpse of me. I thought, oh my goodness, what is he doing? And then I kind of switch off. You know, occasionally I'll look at a performance and I'm like, oh my God, what's that? And I just... I just don't watch it.
Well, I don't know whether, because obviously it was made as a four-part story.
Yeah.
Just redone, made it to, as a movie, and I don't know whether it works as a
the
as
same
a
way
movie, because I think Doctor Who, if you're going to make it as an episodic thing, it's episodic. You've got to have a cliffhanger.
You have that, that drama.
For me, it doesn't work so well as a full-length thing. It's got cliffhangers in the middle of it. It doesn't work because they're coming to the next scene straight afterwards. You know.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. I didn't know that.
They might have edited it slightly differently. But either way, it's a fab story.
Great. I'm glad to be part of this, you know, this monumental historical, you know, Doctor Who. You know, it's like, wow, it's such a legacy.
Did you get to do a lot of conventions?
I've done one previously before, and that was really fun. It was my first one. I was like, what is this all about? You know, and I've seen a lot of my...
Doctorish, that's really...
Well, this is why I thought, let me have something a little bit Doctor Who-ish with my waistcoat and stuff. I thought, you know, but I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that outdo me, you know. And it's a young guy, he's dressed like the new Doctor, and he's got the grace book grey hair.
He was watching John Levine last night, and he was doing this. And John Levine was actually... picking on people in the audience, and I thought, if he sees him, he's going to sleep with his sprayed grey hair.
I know, amazing. It's really good. But it's good they're enjoying it, and they're part of it. And I think it's also an escape as well, especially these days. You know, you really need to get away, you know, Brexit and everything happening. You just want to really escape. But I think that the thing about Doctor Who has become such an... It is an international story as far as all the different doctors and... and I have, as I remember as a kid, the Daleks and William Hartnell.
Yeah, and Cybermen.
I remember all that, the Cybermen. And I had a Dalek. That's right, as a kid I had a Dalek. What I didn't like, I will say, is the Peter Cushing movies.
Yeah,
they never did it for me.
They're a complete departure, aren't they?
Very 60s, very... Yeah. And I couldn't understand why I didn't have... William Hartnell had that.
He was a doctor.
While Peter Cushing was like an old guy, just, you know, you know, what's happening? Oh, hello, my dear. You know, and he wasn't that old at the time.
No.
So they were making him look older, and it didn't have the same sort of impact, you know. The Daleks always worked for me, and I must admit, I always look forward to seeing a Dalek.
It's because they brought them back with even more powerful, you know, more scarier and more weird, didn't they? They brought them back in the news.
But they based them on the Nazis, didn't they?
Apparently so, yeah.
Yeah, the whole, the helmets and stuff, you know. We will exterminate, you know. Without the German accent.
Sinister. Of course, a lot of that. I would think they based the Daleks on the Nazis and the March of the Cybermen also.
When
they did those scenes in London.
Yeah.
But obviously, in the 60s it was quite raw, wasn't it?
Definitely.
15 years or so since the war had happened. So. But anyway, thank you, Lee.
Thank you.
An absolute pleasure.
Great.
Thank you.
podcast is an apvservices.co.uk production and is a proud member of the Doctor Who Podcast Alliance. The 20 Megabyte Doctor Who Podcast is sponsored by whoone.co.uk, lavazi.co.uk and audible.com. Doctor Who is a trademark of the BBC. No copyright infringement intended.